take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting October 27th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in Radical History for October 27th, 1889, famed anarchist general Nestor Makhno is born in Ukraine. He would lead the anarchist Black Army against the Bolshevik Revolution. From the song dedicated to his life, quote, "Our flag's black in the wind, black for our sorrow, red for our blood," unquote.
People, the time has come.
This is your radio supporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, October 27th, in 1919, Edmund Goldman, a well-known anarchist and political activist, appeared before federal immigration authorities at Ellis Island to speak out about her deportation order. Goldman had just been released from prison after serving 2 years for opposing the U.S. military draft during World War I. During her hearing, she expressed the irony of a government that waged wars in the name of democracy while it suppressed free speech and criminalized peaceful resistance. Instead, she felt, quote, "Free expression of the hopes and aspirations of people is the greatest and only safety in sane society," unquote. I can get down with that, but I would add that people's free expression of their hopes for their government will also keep us in check. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on October 27th, 1920, in an attempt to get all the radicals out of Philadelphia textile mills, 40,000 workers are fired en masse. Also in the state in 1932, Bing Crosby would record "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" The recording would enjoy considerable popularity in a year when few Americans could afford to buy records. This downbeat song reflected the plight of World War I veterans, thousands of whom decamped in Washington, D.C. this year. These past veterans, known as the Bonus Marchers, were brutally routed via tanks, sabers, and tear gas one night by forces commanded by then Army Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur, showing once again how disposable veterans are to the government and how much respect they have for them once they are all done up serving their needs. Also on October 27, 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee calls its first witness to Hollywood loyalty hearings and a grand demonstration of what freedom is really all about in America. Lastly, on October 27, 1990, Muslims, Jehovah's Witness materials, propaganda, and satanic books are burned in Dayton, Ohio by a religious right mob. This week in Radical History for October 28, 1902, in Kansas, working woman, universalist, feminist, and anarchist writer Kate Austin dies. Also on October 28, 1929, stock exchange collapse, Black Friday, starting the Great Depression and world economic crisis. Deja vu all over again. Also on this date in 1965, Pope John VI formally absolves the Jews of collective guilt for the crucifixion of Jesus. Today, I, Pope Michael, do not absolve the Catholic Church of all its historic barbarism in the name of its gods. So mote it be. Today in 1997, a doctor in New York is one of a long string of people injured as a bullet is shot into his home by an anti-abortionist. Most of such assassination attempts are fueled by right-wing hate groups and all in the name of their God. While using religiously fundamentalist ideology, they borrow from groups such as the KKK and Heritage Foundation. Today, 6 Minneapolis residents are facing terrorism charges for the crime of organizing the protests against the RNC last month. Meanwhile, VP candidate Palin would argue that abortion provider assassins are not terrorists in her small, hate-filled, God-loving mind. This week in Radical History for October 29, 1901, Leon Czolgosz, anarchist, electrocuted for the assassination of U.S. President McKinley. His last words were, "I killed the president because he's an enemy of the people, the good working people, and I am not sorry for the crime."
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 29th in 1929, Black Tuesday, also known as the Wall Street Crash of 1929, occurred, devastating the stock market and causing widespread economic panic throughout America. Although there is debate about whether the crash of 29 was a result of the Great Depression or a cause, it is definitely agreed that it was one of the most devastating stock market crashes in American history. The quick drop in stock prices caused bankruptcies and severe financial difficulties for businesses, The result was mass unemployment and quickly deteriorating living conditions for the American working class, which happens to be a majority of the American population. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
50 years later, 1979, up against the wall, direct action disrupts New York Stock Exchange and the financial district in New York. There'd be over 1,000 arrests. Lastly, for October 29, 1966, the National Organization of Women is founded in Washington, D.C. This week in radical history, for October 30, 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. is arrested and jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, on charges stemming from a demonstration 4 years previous. Quote, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' councils, nor the Ku Klux Klanners, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice. Martin Luther King. Also on October 30th, at the height of tension over World War II coming, the nation, and especially upstate New Yorkers, start to panic at this broadcast, which you're about to hear part of, which was broadcast live, uninterrupted, 70 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity in downtown New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that joins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain is conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Ah, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. Those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. Some shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror. But there's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. I see them caught up by the woods of fires. Their gas tank tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. We continue now with our piano interlude.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill, their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be, the Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
A small segment from Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, broadcasted 7 years ago on this date.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is John Roberts, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where you hear the Palestinian narrative and Palestinian voice so rarely featured in the mainstream media. Recently, Palestinian professor Mazen Kumsaya visited the Boston area on a speaking tour. This Week in Palestine recorded his presentation at Boston College and will feature it over two broadcasts because of its length. Mazen Kumsaya is a Palestinian biologist and geneticist who taught at both Duke and Yale universities, but is now back in Palestine teaching at Bethlehem and Be'er Zeit universities in the West Bank. He also has founded a natural history museum in Bethlehem, where he is doing interesting and vital work with students and volunteers. That aspect of his work we will feature in a future broadcast. He's also an author and activist, and it is these aspects of his work that form the basis of our broadcast today. Because of its length, we get right to it. Here is Professor Mazen Kumsaya speaking at Boston College.
Thanks for coming, especially on a nice Sunday when you should be out doing some other things. I am actually not going to be very coherent because I have slept only like 5 hours. I got up very early this morning to go to the airport in Washington, D.C., and also I came just the night before to a conference yesterday in Washington, the Holy Land, the Ecumenical Christian Foundation Conference. And so I didn't sleep on the flight over from Amman, Paris, Washington, and then now Washington, Boston. And also at every step of this trip, multiple stops, I was selected for extra screening, patting down, checking everything. My boarding passes have the triple S, quadruple S, four S's on it. For extra risk security. I don't know why. I haven't, to my knowledge, I have not done anything illegal in the U.S. I did do things against Israeli law, but that's because they were unjust laws. And so, for example, I do go into Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem is off limits to us Palestinians. I smuggle myself in, literally, because we are told I cannot enter Jerusalem. I, as a Palestinian Christian who was born there, and I was a high school teacher even in Jerusalem, I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, which is only like 4 miles from the museum where I work, and I'm not allowed to enter there. Even, by the way, with my American passport, I'm not allowed to enter Jerusalem. Whereas any Jew in the world or convert to Judaism not only can come to Jerusalem, they can get automatic citizenship, settle in Jerusalem on stolen Palestinian land, and can freely move anywhere they want to. But that's the nature of what we face. Now, I don't know how much you want to know about what subjects, so I'm going to just run through my usual slides that I kind of give to talks in various places, and then see what your interests are in question and answer session. We can discuss whatever subject. As mentioned, environment, politics, the global warming that we're facing, all this stuff, because it's really, I say we're facing as humanity a lot of challenges, but as humans, it's an existential struggle for us, and we definitely can solve these challenges if we put our act together, if we don't listen to the politicians. In my humble opinion, who are always after money and after power, and they really don't care what the common people want. And I'm talking about all politicians, yes, including Palestinian politicians, unfortunately. It was mentioned that I wrote two books. One is about sharing the land of Canaan, and one about popular resistance in Palestine. They're available in many languages. Those of you who are students and want to have access to the books, just let me know. I'm happy to share them with you. Sharing the Land of Canaan actually is on my website, and the other one is still, they prevent me from putting it on my website, but if you want, I could send you a PDF of it. I don't care. I don't believe in copyright and money and all that stuff. But anyways, I think we have to realize that first we have to be humble to realize that we are nothing compared to this universe that's out there. You know, Earth is just this small planet, but it's all we have. And it's a fragile planet, actually. It's a planet that supports life, and it's the only one that we know of so far that supports life. So, and we in Palestine, of course, are a very small, tiny part of this planet. It's a special place in some sense because of its history, but no more and no less. We Palestinians and the people or Jews or whoever lives there are certainly nothing special. We're just human beings like everybody else. But we have kind of a unique history. And this unique history includes the fact that this is the Fertile Crescent, or at least part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first went from hunter-gatherer to agriculture. This is where, of course, when you go from hunter-gatherer to agriculture, you have more time on your hand, so you also start inventing things like civilization. And quote-unquote, you know. So, and the reason for that is an accident of geography, by the way. An accident of geography and geology, that this is a rich part of the world in terms of the topography and the landscape, and there's a lot of wild plants and animals there. Biodiversity is very high for a mild climate latitude, if you want, compared to other parts that are on the same latitude as we are. We're also unique in being at the center connection between Europe, Asia, and Africa. That pivot, if you want. And because of that also, it's kind of unique. For example, in migration of birds, there are over 500 million birds that pass through Palestine on annual migration from Europe to North Africa, to Africa, basically. And as I said, as we humans in Palestine, in Syria and in Iraq, in this part, what's now called Palestine, Syria and Iraq, this fertile crescent, we developed agriculture like domesticated wheat and barley and lentils and chickpeas. You know, chickpeas make hummus and things like that. And also domesticated animals like goats and donkeys and so forth. And started to have more time on our hand, because when you're a hunter-gatherer, you have to catch your food and collect it daily. Very hard work. But when you are an agricultural community, you have time. So you develop methods of doing things and housing and clothing and alphabet. For example, the alphabet that you use here actually comes from our part of the world. I don't know if you know why the A is shaped like this. It's from Aleph, which is a bull in Aramaic with the two horns. The B is from Beit, because it's a line, half circle. Beit is a house. So when you turn it sideways, you get the B. That's in Latin or English. That's where it came from. It comes from our part of the world. Now, this part of the world has one of the oldest, by the way, continuously inhabited town on earth, which is Jericho. Over 10,000 years of civilization, if you want. I say, you know, jokingly civilization, because I think humans have a long way to be civilized, but that's another story. There is conflict, of course, in this part of the world. And conflict that creates a lot of injustice. And I was thinking, I was actually telling Rains in the car how I feel the injustice of me being searched and so forth. But I told the TSA people, Homeland Security people, that, at least you didn't shoot me. And that's okay, you know. It's still a minor injustice that you are selecting me for no reason, just because I write a lecture about Palestine and because Israel told you to select me. I'm going to challenge it, by the way. I'm going to go after them with the Freedom of Information Act and try to find out, to try to prevent them from doing this more and more to me. But I said to him, there are people that are subjected to far worse injustice. And I told Rains in the car that just yesterday, three Palestinians were killed, young people. And that makes the number of Palestinians killed over 40 since the beginning of this month, including 10 children. And the people who were killed yesterday, the three people who were killed, one of them tried to stab a soldier, and that's evident that he tried to stab a soldier. Actually, there's a picture of a soldier with a machine gun running away from him with the guy with the knife, which is kind of amazing. But two soldiers actually ran away from him, and then they shot him. But the other two were innocent bystanders who had nothing to do. One of them was a girl, 16 years old. And clearly she was not carrying any knife or object or anything else. I just shot her because she's Palestinian. The other guy, there's even the video of it, ironically, which shows that a settler shot him, an Israeli settler, shot this guy in Hebron. And then the soldiers came after they heard the shots, three, four shots. So they came running, and they saw the settler with the gun pointed at this guy on the ground. So they asked the settler to step back. And then one of the soldiers comes to the other soldier and hands him a knife. And the other soldier leans down, put the knife next to the guy to frame him that he was using a knife. This is the kind of injustice that happens on a daily basis. And I haven't watched the news today to see what actually happened today or in the past 24 hours since I've been on the flights and so forth. But there may be other things that happened. So with this injustice that's present today, this conflict that's present today, obviously nobody likes it. Nobody enjoys being in such a situation. So one wants to get rid of this illness, if you want, which is the conflict. And as a person who taught in medical schools, I tell my students, I told my students at the medical schools at Duke and Yale, that as a medical doctor, when you reach that level, what is your primary responsibility? They said treatment. I said, well, before treatment, well, diagnosis. Okay, so you have to make the right diagnosis. Because if you apply treatment with the wrong diagnosis, and it doesn't matter what treatment you apply, it is not going to work. So you have to really think about what is the real diagnosis. Why is there a problem? Why is there a conflict? Is conflict intrinsic to human nature? Is conflict biologic? Is there a gene for conflict? And as a biologist, I can tell you, no. We mapped the human genome now, and we have not found a gene that says for war or for killing or anything else. So this is all educated. And so what is this particular conflict about? And how did it come about? And what is the educational components, if you want? And this is the analytical mind of my biology training that goes about things. And when I did that, and I went to do this kind of research, if you want, and it is research. And by the way, they don't teach us at schools any of this stuff, unfortunately. Even in Palestinian schools, they don't teach real history. They teach a mythological history that's built on all sorts of notions that are not objective and not correct. So what is the real history, and why is there a conflict there? Is conflict integral to the Middle East? Maybe, you know, there's Hollywood likes us to think, actually, in many movies I noticed, they put this intentionally, by the way, I believe. Like, and the movie would be about a love story or about crime or anything else, totally unrelated to politics. And then, like, when they show the hero or somebody standing in front of a TV, switching news, and on the news, well, the Middle East, in the future even, like science fiction movies, 20 years, 50 years down the road, the Middle East has people killing it, as if it's going to be happening 50 years from now or 100 years from now. Or they go back in the past and try to think that we have been killing each other for hundreds of years, as some Zionists like to say. Well, the reality is this is not true. Objectively, it's not true. I challenge you, as anybody can do this research. I tell my students, by the way, don't believe anything I say. You can always research things yourself. Go research how much of our history in Palestine and how much of the history in Europe has been a history of conflict, wars. And you will find that in Europe, actually, it's like 5 or 10 times more as a percentage of European history than in our history. And in our history, it may be 0.1% or 0.5% of our history that has been a conflict history over the past 10,000 years, for example. So we actually have a very small proportion of our history that involved active conflict, if you want. And what were these conflicts about? What is conflict about? Where does it come from? Is it because of religions, for example, which is another mythology that they try to impose on us? And now it's all over the media, you know, the Muslims this, Islam this, this, that. Is it because of religion? And, you know, I'm not a very religious person. My family is Christian, by the way, but I, if you want my history, I have, my mother is Lutheran, my father is Greek Orthodox, my wife is Chinese American, her family is Buddhist, my sister went to Utah, became a Mormon, I have a cousin who converted to Islam, so on religions I'm totally confused. But on the issue of the role of religion in conflict, I'm not confused. There was never, ever a conflict in Palestinian history that was truly because of religion. Never. You might say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Yes, and show me. I mean, what is it? Give me an example. The Crusaders, for example. Were the Crusaders about Christianity? Did Christianity teach the Crusaders to go kill Jews and Muslims and kill my ancestors who happened to be Christians of another denomination? No, it was for money, for resources, for problems in Europe. the princes were fighting each other in Europe, and the Pope said, well, instead of fighting each other, let's get them all to go fight somebody else. So it's a way of unifying them. Whatever, you can analyze the actual reasons, but really the actual reasons were not about liberating the holy sites from the infidels, the Muslims. Actually, at the time the Crusaders came to Palestine, all the Christian holy sites in Palestine were under Christian jurisdiction. And there were actually more Christians and Jews in Jerusalem than there were Muslims in Jerusalem. This is a fact of history. At the time the Crusaders came, there were more Christians in Palestine than when the Crusaders finished their crusades, or, you know, at the height of their crusades. So it was not about Christianity or about promotion of Christianity. They came for other reasons, and usually for... I hate to make a simplified generalization, but essentially most, if not all, wars are about money. About money, about resources, about getting extra resources, getting, you know, people to... So, of course, in this very long history, as I said, 10,000 years history of civilization, these conflicts, which tried to... gets the resources and the money and achieve some things, achieved part of their objective in that they did become richer or whatever. But the stated objectives they gave, for example, in the case of the Crusaders, the stated objective was to make Palestine part of Christendom, a Christian state. There was also a Muslim ruler who said, this, the purpose of my attacking the Christians and Jews in Palestine, this was 500-600 years ago, before the Ottomans, was to make Palestine a Muslim country. That was his stated objective, but as I said, it was not the real objective. But whatever, the stated objective even was a failure, a dismal failure. Look at the stated objective of the Crusaders, to make Palestine Christendom. At the height of the Crusaders, there were more non-Jews, non-Christians in Palestine than there were Christians in Palestine, at the height of the Crusaders. So they failed miserably. Why did they fail? And I think this is an important lesson in history. Why do these movements fail? They fail because, as a biologist, I can tell you, efforts to make our environment dominated by one species is actually not healthy and is rejected by the ecosystem. When we look at ecosystems and we see ecosystems that are healthy, they have many species with few individuals of each different species. Ecosystems that are disturbed and bad and unhealthy will have a dominance of one species. A lot of rats or a lot of crows. Not that I have anything against rats or crows. They are very nice species. But the dominance of one or two species tells you there's something wrong with this ecosystem and it's unstable and it will not survive. And this is indeed what also, in my estimation, is also true of humanity. Any attempt to make uniformity among humans is unhealthy and unstable. Take the example of the Nazis, for example, their attempt to make the uniformity of, you know, Aryan, white, German-speaking people. It's failed. So any attempt to try and make uniformity is faced with failure. And this is more true in Palestine, in my humble opinion, than anywhere else on earth. Why? Because Palestine is an ancient country and so is a place where there is a lot of religions, a lot of cultures, a lot of languages. We have Baha'i, we have Christian, we have Druze, we have Muslim, we have Jews. You know, we have a variety of people. To try and make it uniform is at best a futile effort, bound to fail. The Crusaders were bound to fail. That one Muslim ruler who tried to make it the Muslim state was bound to fail and did fail. And they never succeed. These movements never succeed. The last movement to try to do this and also did not succeed is called Zionism, which is the idea of take Palestine and make it into the Jewish state of Israel. Now, notice I use past tense, did not succeed, not future tense that will not succeed. It actually failed miserably. And we can talk more in detail about this, but what is the origin of this movement and why did it come about? Well, it came about in Europe. Unfortunately, a lot of stupid ideas in the universe come out of Europe. But that's the case, you know. Because for some reason, I don't know why, we have to analyze it. One of you needs to do research on this. Why is colonialism came out of Europe, not out of Asia? Why is imperialism came out of Europe, not out of Asia? Why is Nazism came out of Europe, not out of... Why is Zionism came out of Europe? It's an interesting phenomenon, but I think it needs to be investigated. But anyways, so the Zionism came out of Europe, and it was a simple idea. It said that Jews of Europe and from other parts of the world need to go and create a Jewish state in Palestine where Jews run their own affairs, they control the country, whatever. Now, when this idea came in the mid to late 19th century, Palestine was 97% not Jewish. How are you going to take a country that's 97% not Jewish and make it the Jewish state of Israel? And the early Zionists realized this conundrum, this problem. Herzl, for example, he sent two rabbis to study Palestine in 1897. And the two rabbis were supposed to report to him in detail about the country and suitability of it being a Jewish state, etc. And the two rabbis, before they sent their report to Vienna, they sent a telegram to Vienna. And the telegram simply said, and really Herzl didn't need to read the full report because the telegram said it all. Telegram simply said, the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. It's a wonderful country for a Jewish state, but there are people here. What are we going to do with these people? Well, the answer was obvious. They had to go. So in the process, I mean, I don't want to make this a history lesson. This is colonialism. You want to remove the natives somehow. You want to separate the natives from their land, because after all, to make a Jewish state, you need the land. And the land is owned by the natives. How are you going to remove the natives from the land? You can either commit genocide, which happened, by the way, in Australia and North America, South America, of Native Americans, or you can move them out, or you can use them as slave labor, or some method to take care of the natives and separate them from their land. The Zionists chose what they called cleansing. This is their word, by the way, not my word. Cleansing means that you have to clean the land of its native people. Just like you would clean your agricultural land of thorns and stones, you want to clear the land of the native people. And so cleansing meant, and there's a book on this by Ilan Pape called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, meant that 530 villages and towns, which you see in the red dots, were wiped out, and people were made refugees. And today, 7 million of us are refugees or displaced people, living in various places like Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and also inside the state. Israel was created on 78% of the land of Palestine, and in 1967, Israel expanded to acquire the remaining 22% of Palestine. And in these processes, removing people from their land and building settlements, for example, you can see the names of the major settlements in the West Bank on the right-hand side of that map. The blue here is the settlements in the Bethlehem area around my village in, of Beit Sahur, around Bethlehem area where I teach at Bethlehem University. And you can see how the settlements are, and the light blue is also areas of intended expansion of the settlements on our land. From Beit Sahur, they took land from my relatives. About 30% of the land of Beit Sahur is gone because of these settlements that are to the north of Beit Sahur. Now, colonialism is never done in one fell swoop. I mean, you know that in North America, for example, the early colonies started and then they expanded westward. And the maps on the lower right side of the U.S. Actually inspired me and my son to draw the map over there on the top when he was in high school. And that map is now used everywhere. So we were the original people who created this shrinking map of Palestine. But thank you. But that came to us from this, you know, from, inspired by what happened here. I mean, I hate to use the word inspired with such tragic consequences. There are, of course, differences. I mean, it's not the same situation as in North America, because even you know, when North America was colonized and so forth, a lot of natives were killed and died because of diseases the Europeans brought, etc. In our case, there was literal ethnic cleansing to remove them into refugee camps and so forth. So a more appropriate analogy perhaps is South Africa, where the blacks were relegated to small areas called Bantustans, countries for the black people. And in South Africa, these black areas, if you want, were 11.5% of the land of South Africa. In our case, we are now reduced to 8.3% of our historic land of Palestine. On this 8.3% in these isolated cantons or ghettos, if you want, live 6.2 million Palestinians. And in the other 91.7% of the land live 6.1 million Israeli Jews. More than half of them are new immigrants. This picture from Ghada Karmi and Ellen Siegel. Ellen, by the way, was in Boston. I don't know if she's still in Boston. She was a nurse. And this is an old picture of them in 1973, you know, and Ghada lives in London, and here they are in front of the Israeli embassy in consulate in Chicago. And, you know, the signs are self-explanatory about what the reality that we face as Palestinians, if you want. Okay, if this is what I said to you so far in this section, and is what I call the diagnosis. The diagnosis is that we have colonialism, and diagnosis and the symptoms of this can be very frustrating, you know. The injustice that I explained earlier against me and against others is frustrating sometimes. But we should not be overwhelmed with the diagnosis. You know, when doctor tells me, somebody you have cancer, you know, I shouldn't just say, well, let's go jump off a roof, you know. You have to think, is there therapy for this? Is there a possibility of resolving this? And more importantly, what's a prognosis? You know, prognosis. What's the likelihood of a cure or getting better and so forth? So I think it's important to talk about diagnosis and make the right diagnosis, because as I said, if you make the wrong diagnosis, especially if you confuse one of the symptoms with the diagnosis, then you are in trouble. If you have cancer, for example, and you have, let's say, many symptoms, including skin rash, and then you say, well, that disease I have is something that a dermatologist should take care of and give me some cream and that's it. No, I'm sorry, it may make you feel better, but it is not going to be a cure. You really have to go to the etiology, as we say, or the underlying cause of this, and treat that. So the underlying cause in our situation is colonialism. And colonialism is a harsh term, it may seem, and it may seem radical sometimes when I speak. But actually, it's not so radical, because the Zionists themselves use that term. The first organization they set up to colonize Palestine, they themselves called Jewish Colonization Association. So it is not a harsh term. The word apartheid, by the way, is not such a harsh term also, because actually the Zionists themselves used it. the Israeli government says that our system is the system of Hafrada. Hafrada in Hebrew means in English segregation. And what's the word segregation in Afrikaner language? Apartheid. So it's a system of segregation, system of apartheid, system of racism, which is illustrated by this picture. If this is the diagnosis, okay, you know, the wall is a problem, the settlements are problems, the killing that's happening now, these Palestinian children, and occasionally one Israeli guy who gets stabbed and dies, this is all symptoms. They're not the underlying cause. I mean, they're important to study them and understand them because the collection of these symptoms leads you to the right diagnosis. And certainly you should also deal with the symptoms. And sometimes we ask patients, what is your worst symptom? So that we can address that first, because that makes the patient feel better, that we are giving them the worst kind of, you know, what bothers you most, you know, so to speak. So we do need to do this kind of therapy, in my humble opinion. So what is therapy? Well, I mean, you look at colonial, anti-colonial struggles in history. As a scientist, that's what I do. I examine history. I show patient history. Patient history, here we study the patient history. What happened? How it developed? What is then the best therapies for that kind of situation? So you try to deal with the etiology, with the underlying cause. And the underlying cause here of colonialism. So colonialism in the past, there's one of three possible outcomes for colonialism that stabilize the situation, let alone solve it, but at least stabilize it. One possible outcome is what happened in Australia and North America, if you want, where the natives are obliterated to such a stage that there are so few of them that you can afford to even apologize to them. In Australia, they now have a National Apology Day, where the Australian whites, they come to the remaining Aborigines and say, we're sorry, you know, we screwed you, we killed your ancestors, forgive us. And they genuinely mean it. I don't mean to mock this or anything. I think they mean it. But even if Australia decides tomorrow to give $1 million to each of the Aborigines who remain in Australia, the Australian budget would decrease by 0.1% for 1 year only or something. It is not a big deal, you know. This is one possible stabilizing effect of colonialism, anti-colonialism struggles, you know. And Native Americans still struggle here, by the way, here in Boston, by the way, when they go and have demonstrations on Columbus Day, you know, because they mourn Columbus Day. It's not a day of celebration for them. But anyways, that struggle continues, even though it's stabilized somewhat. The other possible scenario, if you want, is what happened in Algeria, where the white colonizers, in that case French people, pack their bags and went to Europe. I don't say went back to Europe, because actually some of them were like 5th, 6th, 7th generation in Algeria, because 130 years we're talking about, 140 years in Algeria. And they went to Europe. Some of them have never been to France, and they had to go. And at the cost of 1 million native lives, 1 million native Algerians died in the struggle. That's another possible outcome. Both of these outcomes are, I shouldn't maybe use the word impossible, because nothing in life is impossible, but very, very unlikely to happen in our situation in Palestine. What's the third possible scenario? The third possible scenario is similar to what happened in South Africa. Some form of a compromise where people live together in one country, right? This is the reality. What other option is there? Mutual genocide, maybe. That's also very unlikely. So show me one instance in the history of colonial, anti-colonial struggles that were solved via a two-state solution, so to speak. It doesn't happen. It cannot happen. It's impossible. Logistically, ideologically, we can talk more about that, but it's also detailed in my book, Sharing the Land of Canaan, which is available on my website, kumsiya.org. You can read it and understand. So, if what we are after is a better solution than solution one and solution two, if you want, then we have to go for solution three, which is some sort of accommodation within one country, right? And if that is what we aim for, how do we get there? Because I want the patient to return to health, so to speak. Health is, again, diversity. Health to me is diversity. Multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural society. That's healthy society. It's like in my garden, you know, I say in my garden, I love blue color, by the way, but I wouldn't want all my garden to be blue flowers, you know. That would be an ugly garden to me. That would not be a nice garden. So diversity, to go to the issue of diversity. How do we get there? And like any disease, and I keep using this analogy, the first and foremost method of therapy is from the inside out. It's the resistance from the people. The resistance from your body to the virus infection, for example. You get the white blood cells, B cells and T cells, attack the cancer cells or attack the virus or the bacteria and try to eliminate it. Sometimes you need help from outside. You get help from outside, vitamin C, whatever, drugs. But ultimately, your body has to be the primary responsible for its treatment. And I think that's what happens also in human societies, is the primary responsibility for human societies is the resistance to the unjust situation that's created. And we Palestinians have had a long history of resistance. I won't go through detail on this. I wrote another book on this called Popular Resistance in Palestine, History of Hope and Empowerment, where I cite a few examples. Actually, I had to cut it down from 600 pages to 300 pages because the editor says only 300 pages can be printed in these books. So, but even when it was 600, it was one sentence on each event, because we're talking about 130-year history of resistance from the late Ottoman Empire period, where people like this resisted and led resistance and succeeded, by the way, in stopping Zionism in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And then the Zionists moved to Vienna, from Vienna to London, to work on the British Empire, and they got the Balfour Declaration from Britain and also France, by the way, the Jules Cambon Declaration, 1917. They got these two declarations from Britain and France during the First World War. And it was a quid pro quo that they got these two declarations. The quid pro quo was that if you promise us publicly that you will give us Palestine after the war, we will help you win the war. And how will help you win the war? By getting the United States into the war. The U.S. was isolationist then, did not really want to interfere in European wars, the First World War. The Zionists said, don't worry about it. We have people like Brandeis. You know, we have Brandeis University here. Friends of the president, they can lobby and they can get the U.S. into the First World War. And in return, we just want a small piece of land called Palestine. That's how it happened, by a large part, really. And Palestinians continued to resist when the British came and occupied Palestine to fulfill the Balfour Declaration. And these are Palestinian women who were demonstrating and going to meet with the British High Commissioner. For us Palestinians, of course, there are hundreds of forms of resistance. Going to school, like these girls are trying to go to school when the soldier prevents them from going to school, and then having it in the street is a form of resistance. You know, climbing walls, tearing down walls, drilling walls. Just last week they drilled holes through the wall. Resisting home demolitions, resisting uprooting of olive trees. These are all forms of resistance. And we also have other innovative forms of resistance, like, for example, the International Solidarity Movement, where I know some of you here, like Raids, had been with ISM. This was started in my village of Beit Sahur. I'm very proud of this. That started there in the tax revolt in Beit Sahur in 1988. And this has accelerated now, and tens of thousands of internationals have come to join us in the struggle, stand in front of bulldozers, etc., even protected the Church of Nativity here. ISM people got onto the church when it was being shelled by the Israeli military and managed to stop the shelling, actually. And that's because Israel is usually more careful when there's internationals around. Not always, so I don't say it's 100% safe for you to come and join us. But usually when you're around, Israel is less violent than when you're not around. You know, this is Rachel Corey, who was killed when she was bulldozed to death in Rafah area. She came to my village where we trained her in nonviolent resistance for 2 days in Beit Sahur before she decided to go to Rafah. Since I went back to Palestine in 2008, I lost, unfortunately, 16 and now 17, 3 days ago. I lost another colleague, friend of mine, whom I knew, in nonviolent resistance. 17 people so far that I have lost since I came back to Palestine that I knew personally. These are two of the people I knew personally who were killed. Basim Abu Rahman was killed when they shot a tear gas canister that crushed his chest. And when I went to pay respect to his family, I went to his funeral, but also I went a month later to his house, and his sister, Jawahir, on the right, showed me his room, and they had left all his belongings exactly the way they were. But she herself was killed by inhaling tear gas in the same demonstration about 11 months later. This is me being arrested a few times. I actually, you know, it's kind of interesting, but when I left Palestine, I felt very guilty. The first, you know, every time I travel, and I don't like to travel much. I was telling Rains also, I hate traveling. It's stressful on me, much more stressful, even though, of course, I have good food here and is able to move around except for the TSA harassing me. But nobody's checking my ID card at the entrance of Boston College, as Israel checks our ID cards. But I feel guilty being out of the country. I even miss the smell of tear gas, to be honest. For some reason, maybe I got addicted to it or something, I don't know. But this is real. I mean, it's very bizarre. But we were even arrested when we tried to ride the bus. We called it Palestine Freedom Riders. Because these are, we have segregated buses, of course. We have Israeli buses that take settlers from the settlements in Bethlehem or Ramallah or other places that are built on our land. And they take them to Jerusalem. They never check them. Whereas for me, I'm not allowed to go to Jerusalem. So we try to show and highlight this discrimination, this racism in the system of transportation there.
That was a portion of Professor Mazen Kumsaya's address at Boston College, to be continued in a future broadcast, where he describes his work in developing a natural history museum in Bethlehem and how that relates to the resistance. But we have to say goodbye for today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
On my good horse, I call you. tiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 724 of Unwelcome Guests, calling a scad a scad. I'm Robin Upton. Now, you may be wondering what a scad is. Well, a scad is a state crime against democracy. And crimes perpetrated by criminals are worthy of punishment. That's quite a different frame than the rather ill-fitting CIA-framed term conspiracy theory. This week, we begin our radio adaptation of the best movie ever made about Operation Gladio, Alan Frankovich's famous 1992 expose from the Time Watch series. That movie is 2.5 hours long, so inevitably it's going to take more than one episode. We're going to begin with a talk. This is from September the 6th, 2013. It's a soundtrack of a YouTube video, very slightly edited to remove inaudible bits and improve audio quality in various places. But I shall link to the original download from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/724. The speaker is Professor Lance DeHaven Smith.
I thought there would be investigations after the 2000 election and that the crimes that were committed would be prosecuted or at least made known. And what happened instead was people were told, just move on, get over it. You know, there was an investigation, but it was set up so that it said the inquiry was about the technology and it wasn't about the partisanship in the election administration. Have you seen this movie, Recount? It goes over, well, they're actual crimes that are displayed in the movie, but you don't know they're crimes unless you know the law. On the morning after the election, after Election Day, the general counsel, the lawyer in Governor Jeb Bush's office, called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them that the governor didn't want them working for Al Gore. And they didn't work for him. He had to hire an attorney from out of state. They got boys. And this is reported in the movie. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But the reality was that was a felony. That was use of public office for coercion. They were threatening these law firms with loss of business if they took on Gore's case. Well, there were many crimes like that committed during the 2000 election, and nothing was done. And even the movie Recount, you know, it shows James Baker. He comes across as this real tough guy who's, you know, really competent. And Warren Christopher, the leader of the Democratic, of Gore's campaign, comes across as this wimp who gets, you know, pushed around by Baker. The reality was Warren Christopher was following the law. He was doing what the law said. He wanted to do the right thing. And Baker was abusing the law. So it was very frustrating seeing this. And I wrote a book about the 2000 election and specified the crimes that were committed. It was published by the University Press of Florida, an academic book. Got relatively little attention, but it laid the facts were there. But when I saw that nothing was going to happen about it, I started studying this topic. And I came up with this term, state crimes against democracy. I have a definition for it. Concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. It's a terribly turgid definition. The way I developed it was I did a list of what these suspicious events are. There's some that we know, there's no dispute about the Watergate break-in, the crimes of Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame, the lying us into war in Iraq. This is all documented. So we know that there are these high crimes to subvert democratic processes. But I did a list that included others that we suspect that. The Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, the attempt on his life, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life, the 1968 October surprise. I'll tell you about what these are, but anyway, it was a long list. It was like 20-something events, about a third of which were well-confirmed and others we were suspicious about. And I extrapolated from that list to come up with this definition. The basic idea was to have a name for the type of crime that the term conspiracy theory discourages us from speaking about. If we can't name the crime, it's very hard to discuss it. And I was thinking about it like white-collar crime or juvenile crime. We needed a name for this kind of crime that we could then study and get, you know, basic ideas about the profile, who commits these crimes, what are the institutional vulnerabilities. I say actions or inactions. When there's a stand-down like there was on 9/11 appears to be, where people don't defend the country, that's a SCAD. That's a crime in itself. It's a treason, a form of treason. The Vietnam War was started on a false pretense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed. We had our gunships off the islands of North Vietnam, and we were firing on these islands, large cannon fire. And then when the North Vietnamese would come out, we would race back to international waters. And our ships reported they were attacked in the summer of 1964, and they said that they were doing nothing. They were in international waters minding their own business. And so the administration lied to Congress and got that war started when it was really a provocation or a kind of an inaction. I use government insiders because it isn't always the case that it's somebody in government. It can be a political insider. I'm thinking about Nixon. Nixon in 1968 was running for president. And there were peace talks going on between North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. And Nixon thought if they made peace, that he would not win the election, that Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate, would win the election. And so he sent word to North Vietnam, to their president, saying, stop, withdraw from the peace talks, and I'll get you a better deal. That's a treason. I mean, what the man did was treason. The reason we know about this is because Lyndon Johnson, we have a taped telephone call between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, a U.S. senator, Republican leader at the time. And Lyndon Johnson knew that Nixon had done this because he had wiretapped Nixon's plane, his campaign plane. Yeah, I mean, these guys, I mean, they do all this stuff. I mean, Mission Impossible, you know, I mean, this is what these people do. This came out in 1997. And Nixon, Johnson is talking to Dirksen, and he says, I can't believe he's done this. He sabotaged the peace talks. This is treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their faith in their leaders and their country. So we learn about this in 1997. It's in the news one day. You know, and these events, they eventually become known, and we understand the dynamics of them and who was involved. But it's often long after the event. It receives very little attention, and there's no effort to go back and rewrite history with the awareness of this. But anyway, the point was Nixon was not in office, but he was a political insider, and he was doing this as an anti-democratic high crime. I've written a number of articles about this. I won't belabor this much, but I wanted you to know I first wrote about it and defined the state crimes against democracy concept or construct in 2006. And I started working with this guy, Matthew Witt. Matthew T. Witt is a professor at Laverne University in California. And I have to tell you, when you accept that John Kennedy was assassinated by the government, and the evidence is very strong for that, at the very least, the government covered up that it was a conspiracy. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And once you come to understand that, you should rethink how you think about American government. From then on, you should say, well, you know, these guys are capable of some pretty outlandish things. But my tendency was I would admit this about Kennedy. I would admit Watergate. Everybody knows Watergate. I think we tend to minimize it. Watergate is called the Watergate burglary. It was actually a wiretapping. And the people who were arrested were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters. They had wiretapped it 3 weeks prior, and they were they had transcripts and they were reading them. But one of the wiretaps went out, so they were going back into the National Democratic Party headquarters to replace that wiretap, and they got arrested. The two principals, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, worked for the White House and were consultants for the committee to reelect the president. They had planned to kill Jack Anderson, an investigative reporter, and Teddy Kennedy, and they had monitored Teddy Kennedy's activities. But the plan was called off. There are many other things. I mean, when the Watergate, when the guys were arrested, Howard Hunt sent his wife, Dorothy Hunt, to the White House to tell the White House, look, all of these people that have been arrested in Watergate have obligations. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids in college. We expect our expenses to be covered. They said if you're in the CIA and you're arrested overseas, they take care of your family. And they felt like they were working for the president. They thought it was a legitimate operation, and they should be covered. Nixon referred to it as hush money. He understood it was blackmail. John Dean speaks about Dorothy Hunt and says that she was just a completely savvy person, that she was, you know, wife of a CIA agent and had gone all over the world, and she had been a CIA agent in France before she married Howard Hunt. Well, Dorothy gets several hundred thousand dollars for the Watergate burglars, as they call it. They call it the Watergate burglars because the day after it happened, the press secretary of President Nixon said, this is a third-rate burglary attempt. We had nothing to do with it. It's just a screw-up by these overzealous campaigners. And we call it a burglary to this day when it was espionage at the highest level, you know, attacking the opposition Democratic Party during a presidential election. What I wanted to tell you about Dorothy Hunt, though, was she was on a plane flight to Chicago with $10,000 in cash to disperse, and her plane crashed, and she was killed. There was a grand jury impaneled in Chicago, and they brought Robert Haldeman in to testify because they thought it had been that he had killed her, that the Nixon people had killed her. There was no evidence, and all they did was make him testify, and then they let him go. We know this in part because Haldeman tells this to Nixon in the White House, and we have it on the White House tapes. But the point is, Watergate was more than a burglary. I mean, we're talking about a crime spree of fairly wide proportions. The break-in to Howard Hunt's psychiatrist office, Howard Hunt's Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, there were 100 break-ins like that around Washington at that time, where the people's psychiatrists had their files rifled when they were providing service, psychoanalytic services to very important people's wives or husbands. So Watergate was, you know, this massive crime spree. Witt got me thinking about it in those terms. You know, he would say, I would say, well, you know, Nixon was crazy. I thought of Nixon as a, I mean, I think most of us do think about him as, you know, he was paranoid and nuts and a gangster. It took me a while to get used to the idea that a lot of them are like that. It's not just him, you know. So he helped me with that. We wrote an article in 2010 that was published in the American Behavioral Scientist, which is a fairly widely read journal. And it got, there was an op-ed that was written by Mickey Huff, some guys at Project Censored. They said that they wrote about this study and they submitted it to an online website that they had published other things in, and they were told they would not publish this because it was on conspiracy theory. And they were stunned. I mean, they said, this is what we do. We publicize things that are being stifled, and we had this outlet, and they told us that we couldn't publish on that. But I don't think many people would have read it if these guys hadn't publicized it. I wrote an article on the Nuremberg War Crimes trials, and this was kind of shocking to me to go back and read about this. I was teaching a class on international conflict and international law, and so I read the Constitution, I read the UN Charter, and I read the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the 2001 authorization to use military force against the people who planned 9/11 and the 2002. And what I found was we break the law all the time, okay? I mean, when we threaten Syria, that's a violation of the UN Charter. We are signatories to the UN Charter. Our Constitution says our treaties are the highest law of the land. They're higher than the law. They're higher than the Constitution. And that treaty says we're not going to invade people unless we're being attacked. And we have to get a resolution from the United Nations to continue, even if we're attacked. We have to get their support to continue it. But we violate it all the time. Well, I went back. I said, you know, let's look at the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. And to my surprise, what I found was that the first charge in the indictment of the Nazi war criminals was a conspiracy charge. They had conspired to overthrow the parliamentary government in Germany and then warmonger and strike fear into people's hearts and then start an aggressive war against other countries. Do you know what we did to these people? We hung them. They included not only politicians, they included diplomats who were fronting for the Nazi war of aggression. They included journalists who were warmongers and anti-Semites. They included lawyers. We prosecuted these criminal cases because after the war, Stalin said, let's kill all the officers in the Nazi army. And Churchill said, no, we can't do that. Let's kill 20,000 of them. And it was kind of glib, but that's really what they said. And the Americans said, no, we have to teach a lesson to the German people. We have to show them what their leaders did, and we have to show them that they have a responsibility as citizens in an elected representative democracy to not let power be consolidated and to never let this happen again. The Germans have learned that lesson pretty well. I mean, they're very cautious about what they do in foreign policy. Yes, ma'am.
I was just
going
to say, I'm sorry to interrupt your question. My name is Kathleen, and I think that Nazi Germany never really ended. Just a show was put on, and they've been transferred here.
Well, there's an operation called Paperclip. Well, we brought in their intelligence apparatus, basically wholesale, into the United States. And what I did in this article was simply compare what the Bush-Cheney administration did in terms of twisting the intelligence and telling people that we were going to be potentially that this country was trying to build nuclear bombs and had weapons of mass destruction and they could give them to terrorists and we were in peril when they knew otherwise. They knew otherwise. They, you know, the torture that we talk about, the torture occurred in August of 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. There were two people tortured, and they were waterboarded like 186 times. I mean, it was a horrendous thing. But what they were doing was trying to get confessions linking 9/11 to the country of Iraq. And once they couldn't get that, they stopped it. There was Abu Ghraib and all that. That was different. This was torture that came right out of the White House. So anyway, I did this article and said, if you look at what the Bush-Cheney administration did and you compare it to our charges against the Nazis at Nuremberg, you'll find they're parallel, almost exactly, bang, bang, bang. I could not get that published in the United States. I had it reviewed at one journal three times, and the reviewers kept saying, this is a great article. This is an important article. We cannot publish it. Literally, I'd never seen anything like this. I submitted it to Contemporary Politics was the name of the journal, and they published it right away. It's published in London. It's a British journal. It taught me a lesson about what we're up against. Science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's not an organ of legitimation for the power structure in America, but that's pretty much what it appears to be, because it was too controversial. I knew the editor. He was a good friend of mine. He kept trying. He wanted to publish it. And he would send it to three reviewers every time, and we would get these split decisions with a very strong, we can't publish it. I had submitted another article, the one that got published in the American Behavioral Scientist, I submitted to Public Administration Review, the major journal for the American Society of Public Administration. It was reviewed, and two reviewers said we should publish it, and one reviewer said don't. That's a split decision, and the typical thing is they have you make revisions and then publish it. Well, I made the revisions, resubmitted it, and the editor writes me back and says, we had one of the reviewers who had said publish change his mind, and he said don't publish it. He said it was too good for their journal. Honest to God, he said it's too good for our journal. I went to the editorial board meeting that year, and it was in Miami, and complained about it, and this was the only time this had ever happened in the history of the journal. And the editor apologized to me at the meeting. He said, but that's the way it goes. I mean, we're not going to overrule the reviewers. Well, and what I assumed, being a conspiracy theorist, that there had been a conspiracy to keep this from being published. But I've had some interesting experiences with all this. But the reason I tell you about it is you're probably not aware of the academic background on it. And there's a pretty good body of research now that establishes that there are these kinds of crimes. They need to be looked at comparatively and collectively together so you see patterns in them. And that you can't depend on the government to... There are a number of reasons I'll go over why we can't depend on the government to give us the truth. There's a book from Paul Gray MacMillan on state crimes against democracy. That's the title of the book. So the term's getting out. That just came out about 3 months ago. And then this book I wrote because a friend of mine, Mark Crispin Miller at New York University, asked me to write it. I had written a chapter on the 2000 election for a book of his, and it was like 2006, and he said, you ought to write a book on this. And so I really appreciate his help in helping me frame it. I won't belabor this, but I just want to point out that SCAD is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a term for that. It's a term for the crime. We wouldn't say white-collar conspiracy, you know, or white-collar theory. We would say white-collar crime. And it's the same way with state crimes. You have to think in terms of crimes, not theories of crimes. I think you all know that it's a pejorative term. The problems with the term conspiracy theory, it's a totally nonsensical term. The way it's used is anything that is suspicious of government insiders conspiring to subvert democratic processes is considered ludicrous, paranoid. Well, it's nonsensical because we know conspiracies happen. We had Watergate, we had Iran-Contra, we had Plangate. We know conspiracies happen. So it's crazy to say any suspicion of conspiracy has got to be ludicrous. It's quite the opposite. You should be carefully discerning what are reasonable suspicions and what are not. The conspiracy theory label lumps everything together, from aliens taking over the planet to who assassinated Kennedy. And you lump them all together and then take the most ludicrous example and equate all other suspicions with that. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. Conspiracy theory label is un-American. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I urge you to read it. The first part of the Declaration is about inalienable rights, but then it goes on to list a set of crimes that King George committed or was suspected of committing that were intended together to deprive the colonists of their rights as British citizens. And they said they suspected that King was trying to gain tyranny over them and that gave them the right. Not any of the crimes individually, but what they suspected about his motives. So people who say conspiracy theory is ludicrous forget that America was founded on a conspiracy theory. I've already mentioned the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. That's Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court justice, who was our prosecutor in Nuremberg. When people use the term conspiracy theory, what they're forcing on you, in addition to shutting you up and saying that you're crazy, What they're suggesting is that the official account of these events is solid, strong evidence, and what you've got is speculation and, you know, at the very least, dubious. But in reality, if you look at the official accounts of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, basically they are coincidence theories. They're troubling patterns that on their face look suspicious, and they're dismissed as coincidences. When you talk about 9/11 to somebody, or the anthrax letter attacks, or the Kennedy assassination, they will tell you that the American government would not commit crimes like this. And furthermore, if they did commit them, they're not competent enough to do it. They couldn't pull it off. And furthermore, if they, by some fluke, they did succeed in doing one of these things, they couldn't keep it quiet. Somebody would talk. So there's this assumption that you couldn't do these things. They're just on its face. I have Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, the cover up there. It's a great book. What he reminds us of is that the Manhattan Project, which involved 100,000 people developing the atomic bomb, was kept secret throughout World War II. Totally secret. Truman, when he became president after FDR died, he did not know about the atomic bomb for a week until they told him. It's kept secret through compartmentalization, the need to know. People are working on it, but they don't know what it is. They're doing this part, they're doing that part, building the casing, you know. So it's quite easy for the government to keep secrets. It does an excellent job of it. It's got a very sophisticated technique for doing it. Ellsberg also points out that people who are privy to these secrets think they are really special, think that they really know what's up. So they don't want to tell anybody. What they do is remain silent. He says they listen to people and they think in their minds, if this person knew what I knew, they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They consider everybody else really just foolish and out of the loop. And the last problem with the conspiracy theory label is that people who use it attack individuals. They attack individuals who say that John Kennedy was killed by more than one shooter, or 9/11 was a controlled demolition of the buildings. They attack individuals, but they never talk about the conspiracy theories of the institutions, of the government itself. The conspiracy theory of Iraq trying to get nuclear weapons. Now, that was a dangerous conspiracy theory. That was a conspiracy theory that cost 100,000 lives and thousands of our soldiers. That was a dangerous conspiracy. Does anybody say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you shouldn't say that? No, no. So it's really a terrible term. Yes, sir.
One other thing I'd just throw on the false
Please.
Premise. There's a very important false premise that we have like a free press in this country that's aggressive and that is, just can't wait to expose these kind of things. And if you just go to them and show them the evidence, they'll run right over to the cameras. And
you're absolutely correct. There's an article by Sunstein, the guy who wrote about Cass. What is it?
Cass
Sunstein. His wife is Samantha Power, the new UN person. Oh, God. He said exactly what you said. He said the newspapers, that, you know, it would come out. People would sell it. You know, if you knew there was one of these big conspiracies, you'd go to the media and sell your story. If you look at that article and at the footnotes, you know, what's his evidence for this? And he says, well, like, we found out about the warrantless wiretaps that the Bush administration was doing. Well, yeah, we found out about them, but it was only 2 years after the 2004 election. They knew about it at the New York Times and held that until after the election and would never have told us, except one of their reporters, James Ryson, was publishing a book in 2005 that had this in there, that they had done these warrantless wiretaps. So I think that's a very good point, and you're absolutely correct. There's the assumption that the press would talk, and in reality, the press is the big gatekeeper of all this stuff. So why do we use the term conspiracy theory? I mean, if it's so stupid and un-American and nonsensical and befuddling, why do we use it? Well, it turns out that the term was popularized by the Central Intelligence Agency in response to the critics of the Warren Commission. In 1967, the Central Office of the CIA sent a memo to all its stations around the world telling them to contact their media assets and tell them if they come across people criticizing the Warren Commission report to call them conspiracy theorists, say there's no evidence of a conspiracy. say that if there had been a conspiracy, somebody would have talked, the newspapers would have uncovered it. It's all the things we hear today about conspiracy theory, the criticisms of it, were in this memo. In my book, I replicate the memo in the appendix. This was reported in the New York Times in 1976 when the memo was declassified, and mistakenly declassified. It was in the news one day, and that was it. Well, they also said, they said you should tell people who are labeling people conspiracy theorists, they should say that the conspiracy theorist is under the sway of communist propagandists. So the idea was if you talked about Kennedy being assassinated by one of our people, that it was something the communists were pushing on us. And it was applied to the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Wallace. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, the night he was assassinated, the police are radioing. They were chasing people who they thought might have been involved in it. One of them was this woman that wore the polka dot dress. This is our kind of an arcane point. But what's interesting is the police say on the radio, don't chase this person. We don't want another conspiracy theory. So they're already using this term by 1968 and trying to and being concerned about it. This is just a chart showing the number of stories in the New York Times with the term conspiracy theory in it. I don't know what more to say about it, but I did want to mention, does anybody here know about Google Ngram search? N, the letter N, dash Graham, G-R-A-M. They have a program where they've scanned in books, 5 million books, from the year 1500 to 2008, and you can do a word search on terms and see how often it maps it out for you, just like this. And you can put in conspiracy theory, and it'll show you. It's very interesting to work with. One of the things I'm trying to do is develop a forensic science for tracking these memes. Because that's what the government's doing. And we realize that. We know that they, you know, when they devise a war plan, they'll think up some term like, you know, Operation Iraqi Liberation. Oh, no, that was oil. Operation Iraqi Freedom. But we know they do that. But I don't think we realize that they're doing it behind, you know, secretly and inserting these memes into our public discourse. So I'm using the Google Ngram. Yes, sir.
Yeah. What was the very first reference you found in use of the term?
The term conspiracy theory had come up in a book by Charles and Mary Beard in 1913. It was called The Conspiracy Theory of the 14th Amendment, and it was written about in academic. It wasn't popular. You can't find it in the newspapers, but you can find it in their scholarly work. And there was a letter to an editor around 1935 complaining about the conspiracy mentality. And there was a story in like 1963 that was before the Kennedy assassination that was about the conspiracy mindset. So you pick up a little thing, but what you don't see is it being used 25, 30 times. Yeah.
And specifically in the New York Times was the first use.
64.
52?
No, it's picking this up. It picks up an earlier year because the data, as far as I can tell, the Google data has some year mistakes in it. If you go back and track the original sources. The main problem we have that has influenced our thinking with the conspiracy theory label is it causes us to look at these events as isolated events. Like we have conspiracy theories of Kennedy, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but we don't have conspiracy theories of assassinations. We don't look at them together. If I say Kennedy assassination, I'm talking about President Kennedy. Nobody ever uses the term Kennedy assassinations, plural. But those were connected conspiracies, obviously. John Kennedy was running for president. His brother was running for president. When does his brother get killed? His brother gets killed on the night he wins the Democratic primary in California. Okay, so there's obvious connections, and yet we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We don't say 9/11 anthrax. The anthrax occurred immediately after 9/11. It shaped the way we saw it. 9/11 was scary, but it was just in New York. The anthrax could have hit anybody, anywhere. It was very frightening. And yet we separate those in our minds. The term conspiracy, if you have multiple conspiracies, that's called organized crime or serial crime. And we should use that term instead of conspiracy. But it causes us to look at events in isolation. Watergate, burglary. 2000 and the 2004 elections, those were almost identical in terms of the sabotage that was done. Making it difficult for minorities to register, putting too few machines in the urban Democratic stronghold so the lines were real long and people would get discouraged and go away. There were computer anomalies. In Florida, the exit polls showed Gore winning by 3 percentage points. And when the voting returns came back, it was Bush and 500 votes more. Same in Ohio. The exit polls showed Kerry winning by 2 or 3 points. And then when they count the votes, well, that should tell you something. I call it incident-specific myopia. And I point out to people that this is the opposite of the way we view ordinary crimes. If a husband marries a man marries a wealthy woman and she falls in the shower and is killed and he inherits a bunch of money, we're automatically suspicious because it's an improbable event and he benefited. If he then marries another wealthy woman and she falls and hurts or gets killed in a similar accident, we're convinced that this is a plot. I mean, our minds are automatically suspicious. What happened, what they've done, and this is the way these memes work. They're normal, rational processes. When you see things occur, you tend to look at a pattern and you suspect things. And what the conspiracy theory meme is doing is breaking down that rational process. You're not supposed to think about connected crimes. You're not supposed to suspect these people. And so you look at them one by one and you miss the connections between them. Opposite of the way ordinary people... This is a Cass Sunstein article. I may have mentioned it. He is advocating that people who are in conspiracy theory groups online, me and my friends, I guess is who he's talking about, that they should be cognitively disrupted. What I think he means is that they're planting trolls, they're sometimes called, people to get on these online conversations and introduce arguments and ideas that are disruptive and make it very difficult for people to coalesce and strategize constructively about that. I mean, it is breathtaking hypocrisy that what he's proposing. And this is a guy who was head of information, the Office of Information in the Obama administration until recently. What he's saying is we're going to conspire to stop people from saying the government conspires. It's unbelievable. I mean, these people are twisted, deeply twisted. Yeah, I call it linguistic thought control. I think we have to have a name for this stuff, subliminal indoctrination. Sounds kind of paranoid, but if they're doublespeak, yes. Yeah, I went back and read 1984, and he has an appendix in that book that talks about the language and how he thought that they were taking out the emotions out of language and using all these acronyms that shaped your thinking and left you unable to connect your own life to what was going on. I just have a list of 18, 20 SCADs. We've talked about most of these. I include McCarthyism, Oswald, 68 October Surprise in Ellsberg, the attempted assassination of George Wallace. Wallace was running as a third-party candidate. He had the potential to draw away votes from Nixon. Ross Perot, when he ran, he got 20% of the votes nationally, but he took those votes from Bush. And Bush lost to Clinton. So this was a real fear. Wallace said that Nixon was behind it. He went to the FBI and complained about it. He said, how could this guy be stalking me? Where did he get the weapon? He was staying in expensive hotels. How did he know my schedule? You know, it just doesn't make sense. Somebody had to be helping him. Watergate, we've discussed. The attempt on Reagan is a little less clear, but I'll show you some stuff that might surprise you.
Why do you suppose they go for Reagan?
Well, the Reagan got a shot 3 months after he was in office. And the person who shot him, this guy Hinckley, Bush was asked about Hinckley. Did he know him? Had he ever heard of him? He said, no, I don't know anything about these people. I've never heard of them. I have no connection to them. Well, it turns out the Hinckley family have been donating money to his campaigns, lots of money, big money. And then it turned out that the brother, one of the Bush sons,
Neil,
was having dinner with the Hinckley's brother the night after the assassination. And you see connections like that, and it's very troubling. It's very troubling. So I include this as a low probability, but I would still consider it. Wellstone I have in here. He was killed in a plane crash when the Senate was evenly divided and debating about going to war in Iraq. I tell my students, do not fly on airplanes with U.S. senators when the Senate is evenly divided. Okay? It's a big risk. There's practical implications to my theories and research. Iraq, 2004. The bogus terror alerts were when they would raise the thing from yellow to orange. Every time Bush's support would go down, there'd be a terror alert. And that's a manipulation. If you just look at the confirmation, most of these are well confirmed. Maybe not officially, but many officially. A few are not so well confirmed, but still are awfully suspicious, including 9/11. And then the low confirmation are the ones that we just haven't gotten confessions, we haven't gotten people talking, we haven't gotten, you know, forensic evidence, medical evidence, and that kind of thing. This was the article in the Houston Post on Reagan, on Bush's son dining with the suspect's brother. I tracked this down through our interlibrary loan. People who do these kinds of crimes, most of them are lawyers. They know the law. They know it very carefully, and they know what they can do with evidence and so on. They've sworn these secrecy oaths. Ellsberg said that the oath that they swear means that even if they're in Congress and they're asked something, they can't say that they know something, that it overrides their sworn oath to Congress. Compartmentalization, conflicts of interest, we know about that. And then, of course, if worse comes to worse, when we've finally got them pinned down, they pardon everybody who might testify against them. They tend to cluster around elections. So the 64 election, the 68 election, 72 election, the 80, 2000, 2004. So when you have a presidential election, be on the lookout for these things. If you look at what are the most common modus operandi, I'm trying to use this criminological lingo because I find it helpful. The most common is assassinations, and I'm counting these as six, and Leahy and Daschle, the Senate leaders who received the anthrax letters, I don't include in this six, so it would be eight if you included that. So that's a very common one, and it's an old historic political crime. You got somebody that you're competing with, kill them. Manipulation of foreign events just to stir up fear and warmongering is almost as common as assassination. And that's another one that is the language speaks to us about false flag operations and provocations, agents provocateur, that kind of thing. Provocations, the election tampering, and then the burglary. The black bag job is something that they do. But they do, it's more likely they do that to us as opposed to a very high leader. But the most common ones use the skills and tactics of the military and intelligence. It's a signature, in effect. If you look at the confirmation in terms, so these are the high confirmation, the medium, and the low. And if you look at what they are, the things that we don't learn about are assassinations. They're very hard. People don't confess to murder. It's really hard to get that out. They will confess to the, you know, McNamara confessed that they knew the Gulf of Tonkin was bogus. He said this on a film. So they'll confess to things like that, but they won't confess to treason and assassination. It's hard to get that information out. And I think that that's the attitude we should have. When we see an assassination, we should realize it's going to be very hard for us to uncover this. We should be very skeptical about what the government says, and we should be insisting on a thorough investigation. Most of the time, these are done for the benefit of military activities, either start a war, prolong a war, create fear of a war. And there are some that are just political opportunism. You know, Nixon was a murderer, and Johnson was. This has come out recently that he had a hired killer that worked for him in Texas. And when you're running against people like that, you know, you likely, think about it. Basically, everybody that ran against Nixon got killed. Okay? John Kennedy lost, beat Nixon in 1960. He gets assassinated in 63. Robert Kennedy is running against him in 1968 and would have won if he lived. He gets whacked. And George Wallace is running against him in 72 and he gets killed or crippled. You know, if you saw that in an ordinary crime, you know, you'd be saying, well, this is obvious. We should be talking to Nixon. Let's find out where this guy was. What do his friends say? Let's talk to his underlings. Let's promise them if they'll confess that we'll give them a good deal. Any ordinary guy, that's what would happen to him. President of the United States, forget it.
It's not illegal if the president does it.
Yeah, that's what their attitude is. That's what Nixon said. If you look at the assassination targets, it's only presidents. It's not vice presidents. It's not U.S. Supreme Court and senators and presidents. It's not the Supreme Court. I don't want to put any thoughts in anybody's head. But the Supreme Court justices, they don't have protection. They go jogging down in Washington. They have enormous power. People say, well, people don't know who they were. Let me tell you, when I was growing up, there were signs all over the South that said, impeach Earl Warren. Literally. People knew who Earl Warren was in the South. No House member since Gabrielle or until Gabrielle, and there's no evidence to suggest that that was any kind of scan. But, you know, there are a lot of House members. I was in Washington about 6 months ago, was walking around Congress, and Ron Paul came walking by. And I saw her, I said, boy, I just really, you inspire me. I think it's great the things you do. But I thought, he said thanks and walked on, and I thought, hell, I could have killed him right there. I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I don't want you to get that. But, because I like him, at least. But, I mean, the point was, he had no protection. He was just out in the open, and there were no gun screens or anything. There was nothing to prevent people from being around him with weapons. So it's bizarre that it's the president that gets targeted. The one thing about the presidents, they only get shot when you've got a very different vice president who, like Johnson, was a real hawk when Kennedy was a dove. George H.W. Bush was a CIA-connected guy when Reagan was more of an isolationist in some ways. And I think the Bushes figured this out, actually, when George H.W. Bush appointed Dan Quayle as his VP, sort of assassination insurance. and George W. Bush appointed Cheney. I mean, you know, are you really going to kill him and get Cheney for president? Nixon actually said when Ford got appointed vice president, he said, uh-oh, I am really worried now. I wasn't worried before when had Agnew, because they weren't going to impeach me and have Agnew president. But now Ford is vice president, I'm in trouble. So they think about this. They're increasing, and they tend to occur around particular administrations. The Bush people are really very suspect. I think we should be very very cautious about them. There have been a lot of crimes committed while members of their family were in office. And Jeb Bush may run, so. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the King assassination earlier.
Yes.
Of course, William Pepper has done.
It's an excellent book, yes. Yes.
And he's now investigating Robert Kennedy.
Yes. And Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr., came out about 6 months ago and said that he thought it was a conspiracy and that Douglas's book, The Unspeakable, was a good account of it. The Kennedys have never spoken about this. And, you know, people say, well, why? I mean, why would they not speak out? For one thing, they're afraid of getting killed, which is a reasonable fear. But the other thing is there's the elites. This is like the worst taboo. If you speak ill of a fellow elite, it's just a terrible thing. So I think they think of protecting their class interest as more important.
The thing to remember is that this doesn't just happen in this country.
One example, in Mexico in 1994, there was a reformist candidate named Colosio who was murdered by someone within the official party. And it's never been solved. So it happens in other places. But one interesting thing I wanted to question you on is, when your articles are rejected by official magazines and publications, why not go to somewhere like Mother Jones, The Progressive, some of the other really good alternative media out there? It was Mother Jones that exposed the Romney comment before the last...
Do you know what? I've tried to publish in the New York Times. I did get this article in the Guardian. But frankly, my perception is that the left will go all the way up to, but they won't step over the line where we talk about crime. I mean, and we can talk about scandal. We can talk about immoral behavior. But when we talk about crime, that these people are murderers, these people are traitors, these people are embezzlers, you know, nah, we can't talk. We can't say that. That's just too much. It's too much because it implies an action in response. If our leaders are murderers, we can't just sit back. You know, if they're unscrupulous, well, that's okay. If you're, you know, having an affair with the intern, well, that's okay.
I would like to hear your interpretation of why Ronald Reagan chose George H.W. Bush as his vice president.
The story is that Rockefeller went to him and said, "You got to do it. This is our guy." They said in the CIA, Bush had been in the CIA, and they said when the campaign posters were put up surreptitiously in the CIA, there'd be a campaign poster for Reagan Bush, but they would always tear it and take Reagan out. And it was just, but look, they named the building after Bush, the CIA headquarters building. They say he protected them during the Church Commission hearings and all that. I mean, if we saw the Soviet Union, the head of the KGB, become the head of the Soviet Union, which is what we saw with Putin, basically comes the head of Russia, I mean, we'd automatically think, well, this guy's connected. This guy's going to be a gangster of sorts. But we haven't said that about our own system. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have much to say about SCAD since 2008?
The Syria is a SCAD, if we go into that. Libya, in a way, is a SCAD. I mean, it was a violation of international law. It subverted the democratic process because Obama got a tortured Office of Legal Counsel memo saying it wasn't an act of war. So he knew what he was doing. He was subverting it. I'm still holding uncertain the Boston Marathon bombing. I was looking for a connection. There was a peculiar thing that did happen, and that was there were ricin letters that were mailed in Alabama or somewhere. And it occurred right with this. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, this is very similar to 9/11, where you have this bombing terrorist attack and then the chemical, biological attack. And I got to thinking, well, maybe it was a booster shot, you know, from the higher-ups. They thought, you know, we needed a little jolt. They didn't want to do a full-blown nuclear attack or something like that, dirty nuclear bomb somewhere, really get us freaked. But they felt like they needed to. I know it sounds very paranoid, but that's what I, if you go back and read NSC 68 and you realize that the government doesn't trust you, the government thinks you are a liability in their effort to maintain your freedom, your viability. Once you realize that, you have to understand they see this as a responsibility to take care of us, and that may mean sacrificing us at times. Yes.
Behind all of this, these cats, appears to be a huge profit motive, and don't we see the banks?
Yes.
Who make their highest profit by far, funding war. And defense contractors,
yes.
And these are the people at the apex of these crimes. And they make a huge amount of money
yes.
by keeping war.
Yeah, it's a war machine, and it's a financial machine. I have a friend in Australia that writes about economic scads, or he calls them economic scads. They're state crimes that are anti-democratic, but their motive is profit. And And there's some specific instances he has in Australia where the government is literally creating projects to fund these nefarious organizations. And they know it's waste of money. So anyway, yes, it's an economic component. To some extent, I try to stay on the crimes and get the empirical evidence and then abstract away from that to consider what's the nature of the criminal. And what I'm seeing is all the crimes, or very many of them, are related to war and militarism, and certainly they benefit the armaments companies, and to some extent the banks as well. But part of what I'm trying to do is create a foundation of work and forensic methods. I think of it as SCAD detectives. We're like Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century. And we're trying to figure out, how do we investigate these people? When I look at science, the way it progresses, it uses observation methods. So the telescope was a huge advance for us. We saw moons circling around other planets. The microscope leads us to germ theory eventually. The thermometer, temperature, we learned that everybody has the same temperature. They used to think everybody had a different temperature. And so what I've been thinking about is, well, we need observation methods for SCAD detection, for state crime detection. And for example, after every election, we should have an audit of the ballots against the exit polls. If we can't do that, we should at least have the statisticians look at it. They've got techniques now where they can tell when the numbers are made up. There are certain patterns to look for. But that should, and if the government won't do it for us, we're going to have to do it for ourselves. And that's pretty much what's been happening. After 2004, Steve Freeman, a statistician at the University of Pennsylvania, looked at all the exit polls and the election returns and compared them and found that 10 out of 11 battleground states had statistically improbable deviations of the returns from the exit polls, and they always favored Bush. And he said he calculated the probability of that given the difference between the exit poll and the returns and the sample sizes. And he said the odds of that happening by chance were like a zillion to one. But we need methods like that. And his paper was published on the internet, and a lot of people followed it. It led to a lot of activity in Florida about elections. But we need to institutionalize this stuff. Yes, sir, hear you.
Well, we privatized the election counters and contracted it out.
It's unbelievable.
The software is private property?
Yes, it's unbelievable. And why we would put our elections in the hands of people that even if they're angels, why we would do that, it just makes no sense. I was when the Orange Revolution occurred in the Ukraine, one of their candidates who eventually wins the presidency was poisoned with something that made his face real bad. I don't know if you remember that. And they were interviewing his campaign manager right before the election, and they said, well, do you have any worries about the election? He says, yeah, I'm worried about keeping my guy alive. And, they said, well, really? He said, well, yeah, think about it. We're talking billions of dollars in government contracts and policy affecting, all kinds of things. You think the stakes are not enormously high? People wouldn't do something like that? Well, think about the United States elections. Huge financial implications, huge ideological implications. And then we're going to set it up where we have voting machines with no paper trail that are vulnerable to hacking, and that you can actually plant programs in the machines that switch votes between candidates and then erase themselves at the end of the day. I think I need to go back and look at Vince. What was the guy's name? Shot himself twice in the head. Vince Foster. Went to a park and shot himself twice in the head. That's interesting. What I say in the book, actually, is that I think Republicans are more likely to commit these kinds of crimes than Democrats, and that it has to do with the class base of their party, that they are the upper crust. And the people who are wealthy think the laws don't apply to them. Whereas the working people, yeah, the working people, they just obey the laws. Yep.
I was very interested in the fact that assassination seems to be most popular.
Yes.
State crime against democracy. It's ostensibly the CIA can now kill people by...
By drones, cancer, yes.
By giving them cancer,
yeah.
Or heart attacks. So
yep.
Our methods of forensic investigation are going to be a little bit more
difficult. Well, one thing that I've been looking at is the migration of CIA skills from overseas to the United States. What we see is we have a series of assassinations in the 1950s, and then we get a series in the U.S., the assassinations overseas, then they occur in the U.S. We learn to overthrow elections, and then we see election returns that are peculiar. So part of, you know... But it's these guys, I mean, we cannot underestimate their capabilities. I know that people would accuse me of being paranoid and freaked out, but these are scientists. These are dedicated professionals who are dedicated to influencing us.
They have big budgets.
And they have, and they're compartmentalized. And what the compartmentalization allows you to do is take control of it, and the people continue to do their compartmentalized work and don't realize that the operation has been steered to another thing. When John Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy's first reaction was that they had taken the Bay of Pigs people and diverted them to Kennedy, to his brother. Yes.
I'd like to bring out something, too, which is I've noticed something with particularly people on the left that follow Noam Chomsky, whom I respect a great deal of the work of Noam Chomsky, but I think when it comes to conspiracy stuff, he's very vitriolic and calls people a cult. How dare you even suggest that? And there's a presentation that we presented, particularly about 9/11, which falls into the work that Noam Chomsky and others have been doing, which is saying, hey, we're doing all these horrible things in the Middle East, and then all of a sudden, hey, look, okay, this is blowback. This is what we get, and it kind of fit into this narrative, which is, you know, I thought it was blowback too for probably the first year after it happened, but I've noticed that there are some individuals on the left, particularly followers of Chomsky, who feel threatened by and feel that this is actually undermining, and they feel threatened by conspiracy.
Yes.
And feel that it undermines the real work that's going on and needs to happen. Of course, I have a very radically different perspective than that, which I think just kind of gets at the heart of what's going on. But you want to make it...
Yeah, no, Chomsky's a classic case. Chris Hedges is the same way. He's very good. He writes inspiring things, but when it comes down to crime, he just won't go there. And my suspicion is that the reason these people will not go there is they're afraid they'll be discredited. The conspiracy theory term and the norms associated with it are so powerful that if they touch it, they're going to be burned and tarred with that brush. The thing about it that makes it so powerful is that it's a legal thing. Once you get into talking about criminality, well, then we're talking about law enforcement, we're talking about prosecution, we're talking about execution, we're talking about imprisonment. There's an apparatus that swings into motion if you designate something a crime. So I think it's great to talk intellectually about blowback and inequality and that kind of thing. But unless you get it down to these people are not just carrying out a class interest. They're committing crimes. Until we get to that, it's going to be hard for us to stop them. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to mention informationally that one of the early questioners who I didn't turn around to see mentioned Bernays.
Yes.
And there was only one copy of his book circulating here in Colorado, but his books are actually in print.
Yeah.
Propaganda.
Yes.
Opinion. They're in print. You can buy them, and he is a master propagandist, because I remember one of his famous phrases was about something to the effect, the necessary manipulation of the mass public mind.
Yes.
And so he's well worth reading.
Yeah, he was involved in the World War One effort, and a lot of guys came out of that, Harold Laswell and Lipton, yeah. So they, there's a great book in sociology called The Science of Coercion by, I forget the guy's name, but it goes through the history of psychological warfare and says that in sociology, that's what it was. They called it something else, but it was really murder and assassination and all that, and they legitimated it, but that's what they were studying, how to manipulate populations. There's a famous book called by Charles Beard, The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, where he says if you read the Constitution, it protects the class interests of the people who wrote it. And the other thing you might find interesting, Charles Beard developed what came to be called the conspiracy theory of the 14th Amendment. This is the amendment that gives the rights of citizens to corporations. And what Beard said was that the terminology persons was put into the 14th Amendment specifically to have it interpreted by the courts so that they would give these rights to corporations. It was a conspiracy. It involved the railroad lobbyists and the members of Congress who drafted it. A case comes to the Supreme Court in like the mid-1890s, and it was about whether corporations got these rights or not. And a former congressman and a lobbyist for the railroad testified in Congress that, yes, we conspired, we put that language in there, that was our purpose. And the Supreme Court said, you know, you'd think they'd say, you scoundrels, get out of my court. They said, oh, that was the intent. Okay, that's fine. That's what we'll conclude. So what we're dealing with is with corporations, with Citizens United and stuff like that, goes back to this kind of criminality.
So what's your opinion of what is happening in Colorado, where communities are actually going through the law to bring back democracy?
I think it's great.
There are ballot initiatives in five communities.
Yep.
But, of course, our governor is fighting that along with the corporations.
I'm hopeful that we're going to see something like the progressive movement of the early 1900s. That there's some research recently that said that in the early 1900s, before you had the regulatory apparatus established and a lot of the controls in place, people tried to fight these big interests and they had great difficulty with it. They, you know, the unions were broken up by hired thugs and. But they learned, and they developed a consciousness about what was required. And it was the professionalization of government. It was getting rid of elected public officials down through the ranks and the spoil system and all that. So I think part of what's happening with things like fracking and fighting that and working through the local institutions is that you're experimenting and learning what's working, but you're creating the foundations for a much larger movement across a range of issues. Because what we've got with the corporations and finance is just, how can you have a democracy when you've got this kind of concentration of wealth? The capture of the regulatory agencies. I think we should take seriously the oaths of office. And that oath is not just that you're going to obey the law, but you're going to protect, defend, and preserve the Constitution. And that Constitution is designed to empower us as a people. The preamble says we have come together to create this government so that we preserve our security and our rights and our freedoms. And when people swear to it, they're swearing to a broad oath. I mentioned, I think tonight, that when Andrew Johnson was impeached, he was impeached for insulting the Congress was one of the things. But I mean, if you go back and read the impeachments, it wasn't like smoking guns. It was like, this guy's a scoundrel. You know, this guy is a liar, and that's what we've got to get back to. We don't need smoking guns. If we see that people are not protecting our interest, they are committing crimes. They're there to protect our interest. And, you know, I jokingly say, but there's some seriousness, that we should erect a guillotine down in Wall Street, a statue, but a guillotine. And just to remind people, this is what happens when you don't respond to the public over time. Eventually, they're going to get you.
Last night, you mentioned the use of the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. It was purchased, of course, by Life magazine.
Right.
But the publisher of Life at the time was C.L. Jackson, who, in fact, was the architect of a CIA operation in psychological warfare called Operation Mockingbird.
Yes.
It began in 1952.
Yep.
and which continued not only through the period of Kennedy's assassination, but at least up until 1975.
Yes, this is pervasive. There was a National Security Council memo called NSC 68. It's a, you can find it on the internet. It was published in 19, it was produced in 1950. And what it said is the American people don't have the stomach, basically, to stand up toe-to-toe against the Soviet Union in a nuclear standoff, and it was going to take some effort on the part of the leadership to make us realize the importance of doing this. But it was basically a plan to manipulate the mass public, and I think, it, I mean, certainly it included Mockingbird, the infiltration of the civil rights, anti-war, and women's movement. I'm pretty paranoid at this point. I mean, when I see, I wrote an article for The Guardian about 3 weeks ago when they closed the embassies down because of the, they said there was chatter in the electronic communication and there were going to be these attacks. And I wrote this editorial and said, hey, we've seen this before. They do these terror alerts whenever they're in trouble and everybody's criticizing the electronic surveillance, and suddenly the electronic surveillance is saving us from these attacks. It's ridiculous. But it's a pervasive thing. There's a psychoanalyst, a French psychoanalyst named Lacan, who talks about the authoritative, the regime of order, of conceptual order, what's our framework. And I think that's what happens is you plant a few key concepts and events. You know, Gulf of Tonkin attack, 9/11, and everything else gets framed around that, everything downstream. So you can have a democratic process downstream, and you think you're influencing Congress, but they've already set the agenda for you with these state crimes. Okay, let me get back to it, because I get this a lot. People ask me when I go over this, well, what can we do? Well, if everybody's they're running the country like this and staging and orchestrating these events that shape our society and our politics, what can we do? My answer, one simple answer is enforce the law. Enforce the law. We have pretty good laws on the books about conspiracy and fraud. When the Bush administration said that they didn't want to see the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud and that they were sure that yellow cake had been bought at Niger and all that. Well, they had other information that they didn't tell us. They had other information. The Germans had said they didn't trust the intelligence. The people in Niger said, no, this hadn't happened. But they didn't tell us that. They didn't come to us and say, well, we have very confusing intelligence, but we're thinking about launching a war. They said, we have very clear intelligence. That was an act of fraud. And experienced prosecutors have said that George Bush should be prosecuted for murder, that he got these soldiers killed under false pretenses. It's a simple thing of controlling the crime scene after an assassination. We had heard things in 2001, 2002, 2003 about surveillance, but nobody paid much attention to it until we had documents. This is what Ellsberg says in Secrets. He says, you can tell people about it. You can be an insider and say, I heard this, but people will blow you off. But if you have the documents, another thing I think that we need to do is be careful with our language. And that's why I'm looking at conspiracy theory and saying, that is a bad term. That is a bad term. I think that 9/11 is not a good term. I don't mean to say, I'm not sure what we would call it, but by defining it as a date, it elevates the importance of the event, and we need to ask ourselves, where did that term come from? We've never called these events by dates. We didn't call Pearl Harbor 12/7. We didn't call Kennedy 11/22. Why did we call this? Anyway, here I'm going on.
What do you think of the Boston Marathon bomb?
There are a lot of suspicions about it, a lot of questions, and a lot of peculiar coincidences. I'm not compelled by the idea that it was a conspiracy, but I wouldn't rule it out. But here's what I asked myself when I saw it. Were there any other crimes committed around it during the same time? Because when you go back and look at state crimes against democracy, the way I'm defining it. What you see is they occur in clusters. So you have Watergate, you have Ellsberg being stalked, you have the 1968 October surprise. When you see these, what happens is, I think, when these criminal elements get into government and start acting, they don't stop with one crime. When they killed Kennedy, they didn't stop with Kennedy. They killed Oswald. Yes, sir, in the back.
You know. You said what we need to do is enforce the law. That's a great point. So how do you propose to do that?
One thing I'm trying to do is devise forensic techniques that allow us to come forward with something beyond speculation. I have written about it, about let's get laws passed that mandate. One thing I think we should have is if there's an assassination, we should mandate the crime scene is controlled, all the witnesses are interviewed, and those are made public. That's the problem. No. Yeah, I have read about that. There's a guy in Florida that's talking about it. That's right. And that's an important point, too, is to try to find venues that are legal processes. So it's not us just arm-waving, that we can actually get some action, some legal action. A woman who ran for attorney general didn't win in, it was a northeastern state. Anybody know what I'm talking about? She ran with the idea of prosecuting Bush for murder. And she got Bugliosi, the lawyer who prosecuted the Manson for his murder, has written a lot, and she had him as an advisor. But that was their argument, is we need to get this into judicial process.
Have you heard about a movement to have only 3% of Americans pull all their money out of banks?
Oh, God.
Military strike in Syria. Do you think that would be effective?
Well, it would certainly cause a lot of economic damage, and I don't know. I look at Occupy Wall Street as a good example these days of a mass movement. It didn't have a lot of effect on the doing a business in the United States, but it changed the discourse. People now talk about one percenters, and when Romney was running for president, there was that tape where he came out with the 47% who get all this stuff. You know, it really affected the discourse. So my strategy is to affect the discourse. That I think that's something we can do. Buy my book. Write reviews on Amazon. Tell people that use the term state crimes, elite political criminality. Don't let people use the term conspiracy theory. Say, wait a minute, that's a flawed term. We know that came from the CIA. We got no business using this. As it stands, it's the other way around. If you're on TV and you say something like, that's a conspiracy theory, everybody goes, yeah, we shouldn't talk about that. So I think that, I don't mean to say that that's, you know, it's not getting us into grand juries, it's not getting us into court. When I was in Toronto in 2011 for their 10-year hearings, there was a judge there from Italy, who was on the Supreme Court of Italy. And that's what he said, you've got to get this into a court of law. He recommended that we go to, the United Nations has an international criminal court. They can do investigations, and we could investigate the United States, even if the United States said they didn't want to be investigated. And we can't necessarily try anybody, but we can at least investigate and embarrass the heck out of the leadership and change people's thinking about it. So I agree. I think we need to be looking at judicial processes, but also the language, also speaking up. American democracy is in real, real trouble if it even exists anymore.
When you say democracy, are you referring to Republican democracy?
I'm referring to the spirit of popular control of government, and not necessarily representative government, although that's the form that we have. I think we have a constitution that is revered, and a set of founders that are revered. And let me tell you, these people were conspiracy theorists. These people were vigilant. They were concerned about tyranny. They thought that anybody who had power would abuse it. That's why they created the system of checks and balances, to pit against each other the powers. They had these people swear an oath. Their top priority is not to protect the people. It is to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution of the United States. They swear an oath to that. When they violate that oath, that's an impeachable offense, even if it's in the spirit. Go back and look at how we've impeached presidents. When we impeached Andrew Johnson, he was impeached for things like insulting the Congress. Today, it's like you've got to find this smoking gun. You know, what did Nixon know and when did he know it? Wait a minute, you don't have to know that. Nixon hired a bunch of criminals. He should be impeached just for that. So I think that the founders are important and we need to resuscitate that tradition. It gives us a foundation for uniting the right and the left in this country, the Tea Parties and the left, on the rule of law and the Constitution. For one thing, we couldn't go into Syria if we followed the Constitution. I think there's a counterculture forming now because of the mass surveillance that has now been publicized. That it's impossible for the American people not to see themselves as distinct and separate from the government. And the government is not their government anymore. The government is the government. And they are, in a way, the adversary, the enemy, and are being snooped on. And just that state of mind is going to cause what happened in the 60s, a counterculture, where people begin to talk about us and what we think and what we believe and feel, as opposed to what these people in Washington think. The 1% language does that a little bit. But I think, it's not for nothing that somebody like me is writing about state crime. People are waking up. People are beginning to see. They're apathetic, but when it comes to their liberties and their personal freedoms, they take it a little bit more seriously. So I personally think that we're going to see a real revolution of consciousness in this country in the next, maybe. The other thing I would say about looking back at the 60s is that took 10 years. Okay, you had the counterculture movement began in the early 60s on the campuses. You had the anti-war movement really flowing out of the civil rights movement and the women's movement. That all takes about 10 years, and you don't get, you know, the church commission for 15 years. It's a long process. Today we have the internet. Today we have email. Today we have dialogues that occur very quickly on this information. You can go home tonight and look up that dispatch I was telling you about. You have the document. You can say to people, you want to see where conspiracy theory came from? That word? Here, take a look at this. That is light years ahead of where we were in the 60s. So I think that there is a realization coming.
You're talking about moving past left and right and talking about resurrecting constitutional governance and law and order, essentially, I think. But one thing you mentioned when you were talking about the Boston Marathon, that you looked for unusual patterns of what appears to be like illegal activity. And I would add to that also pushing the envelope, for example, in Boston. That was an instance where they instituted martial law.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So they did these demonstrations. Yep. And with a company with a lot of press that's very self-congratulatory, how happy everyone was.
Yep.
That they did that. And that sort of thing, I think.
Well, and I think our attitude should be that should be investigated. All that stuff should be investigated. The Athenians had a process when you got out of office. They went through all of your records to see if you had committed any crimes. And that's what we should do. When you leave office, it should be a thorough inspection of the books and taking depositions from people and so on. These guys would get a lot straighter after that.
And because of the popularity of that movie called Argo, and because of the recent publication, the Christian Science Monitor, of what Bonnie Sager said really happened during the hostage.
Yes.
I'd appreciate it if you could go into that more.
Well, the 1980... October surprise. George Bush was the vice president nominee with Reagan, and he and Bill Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense under Bush, and Bill Casey, this should tell you, William Casey was the campaign manager for the Reagan-Bush campaign, and after they got elected, they made him head of the CIA. Now, you go, campaign manager, CIA, whoa. But same with Bush. I mean, he had been head of the Republican National Party in 1972 when Watergate happened. They make him head of the CIA. Ford puts him in there. But in 1980, Gates, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Casey met with the Iranians and got them to keep the hostages through the election so that Carter would look weak, and it ultimately costed Carter the election. There was an obvious tell in that SCAD, too, and that was they released the hostages on inaugural day. I mean, they do this. This is an amazing thing to me. It's obvious. what's the difficulty is pinning these people down and proving it, but you can see it on the surface. They did an investigation of that in Congress, and Casey and Bush came up with alibis, and of course said it was ludicrous to think they had done it and all that. And then later their alibis came into question. There were real doubts about, they appear to have slipped off from meetings that they were supposed to be in. But when Iran-Contra broke, see what they had told the Iranians in 1980 was that if they would hold the hostages, the Reagan-Bush administration would sell arms to Iran, who were fighting a war with Iraq. And we had propped up the Shah in Iran, and so all their military stuff was American. And they didn't have, like, tires for their airplanes and things like that. And so Reagan and them said, you keep the hostages, and then we'll sell you arms. Well, they start selling arms in April. This later comes in April, right after the inauguration. Later, this perambulates into the Iran-Contra scandal, where they're selling arms to Iran, taking the profits and sending them to rebels who are trying to overtake a democratically elected socialist government in Nicaragua. When they investigated Iran-Contra, the Congress stipulated that they would not go back and look at the 1980 issue. So they did all this investigation of Iran-Contra, but, well, we're not going to go back. But these guys, they all protect each other. They pretty much look after themselves. Nixon was pardoned. Understand this. Nixon was pardoned not just for the crimes he committed, but for all crimes he committed or might have committed while president. Yeah, might have committed. Didn't even get a list. We don't even know what they were. You know? So when I say enforce the law, I mean, for one thing, we should have a law that says you can't pardon people who you order to commit a crime. I mean, geez. I mean, at the very least. Yes.
I was going to ask, how do you enforce the law when the people who are in the power and doing these conspiracies and whatever are the ones that are writing the law?
Yeah, no, it's a very big problem. But one thing that I've argued in my writings and in class is that the people near the bottom of the pyramid, they do the right thing. If we have professional programs and encourage people to take an oath and remember when the hijackers were coming into the United States, there was a guy that stopped one of the hijackers and sent him back. When John Kennedy was killed, the Secret Service took his body back to Washington. There was supposed to be an autopsy in Dallas. The coroner in Dallas tried to stop them, you know, stood in front of the coffin and said, no, I'm not going to, and they moved him aside by force. But at the front line, we've got strong people. I mean, just regular old Americans, you know, they'll speak up. I think having juries instead of these Warren commissions, you know, I mean, you put all of these muckety-mucks on a commission and they're all going to take care of each other because they're thinking about, you know, I don't want to piss this guy off. You know, what am I going to get business from? Are they going to appoint me to something later? Just give me an American jury and let them judge this stuff. So, but part of it is we have to restore our skepticism about our leaders. I mean, the founders thought they were dangerous people.
And thank you to Olivier for pointing me in the direction of that talk. Now, we conclude with part one of a radio adaptation of the best film, I think, that can ever be made about Operation Gladio, because it interviews a lot of the key players, heads of the parliamentary inquiries into Gladio, government officials, members of Gladio, some of them convicted, serving long sentences, and a lot of these people are now deceased. It was something of a breakthrough at the time, which really put Gladio on the map. May, of course, have put Alan Frankovich on the map as far as deep state forces were concerned. Alan Frankovich, you may recall, died ostensibly natural causes of a heart attack after being taken aside for questioning by officials while going through customs at an international airport in the US. Might just be coincidence, perhaps it's my statistical training, but there might be more to it than that. Anyway, I present a radio adaptation of Alan Frankovich's 1992 production, which was broadcast once on BBC Two. I don't think it's ever been repeated, but the video is available for download, and I shall link again from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/724.
Deception is a state of mind, and the mind of the state.
James Jesus Angleton, deep politician, head of CIA counterintelligence, 1954 to 1974. Michel van Usset, Belgian gladio, 1987 to 1991.
One day, a man came to my house and asked me if I would accept a confidential mission. He told me it was something within the framework of NATO. He didn't explain much. It was advisable not to be too specific, because this was one of the most secret organizations that has ever existed. We had a radio at our disposal. Our base was near London, with the second base near Boston.
Une radio à notre disposition, et la base était effectivement située dans les environs de Londres, et une deuxième base se trouvait du côté de Boston.
Decimo Gallo, trainer, Capo Malaggio, Gladio Base.
Ho fatto esercitazioni con reparti speciali.
I work with special American, English, French, and Belgian units. Normally, these exercises involve dropping special forces who came directly from France, Belgium, and England. They were parachuted in, and the men we had trained guided them down to the ground and then helped them to get to safe houses.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra, former member of a neo-fascist group Ordine Nuovo, speaking from his jail cell.
Gladio, così come è stata definita.
Gladio, as it is defined nowadays, forms part of what I have always referred to as parallel structures. That is, an invisible army that is not poised for battle against a hypothetical invader, but rather one meant to be used internally against what the military have always called the fifth column of the USSR, the Communist Party, and the extreme left.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio. On November the 9th, 1990, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giulio Andreotti, revealed to his own parliament and the world the existence of a top-secret European-wide network of secret agents. It was called Gladio. This network of stay-behind groups was intended to fight a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Andreotti's announcement led to an immediate reaction in the capitals of Europe. The suspicion was that some parts of the Gladio structures were involved in internal subversion.
Senator Roger Lallemand, head of the Belgian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
The Belgian Stay Behind Network was brought to our attention by what they call Gladio, the scandal unleashed after the revelation of the Stay Behinds in Italy. Our Minister of Defense was called by his Italian colleague, who wanted to know what decisions had been taken at the last meeting of the European Stay Behind.
Guy Coem, Belgian Defence Minister, 1988 to 1991.
C'était un soir de novembre 1990.
In November 1990, an Italian delegation came to ask me if I knew what Gladio was. I didn't know anything, except that on that very day, I read about it in an Italian newspaper on a flight to Brussels. In this way, I learned of the scandal in Italy called Gladio.
Senator Roger Lallemand.
The minister let this amazing detail be known that he didn't know that a Sébéine existed in the Belgian army and state security. Gladio has always been protected. This is one clear example.
Senator Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
Moro was called to testify. They asked if he knew of a parallel secret structure inside of the services. And Moro asked the services what sort of answer he should give. They told him it didn't exist. And so Moro said, I've been told that this doesn't exist.
Carlo Schmidt, head of the Swiss parliamentary inquiry into Gladio. Part of the Swiss authorities knew of the existence of this structure. Some MPs in a secret council had some control, but it was ineffective because these MPs knew virtually nothing. Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
These parallel structures use the extreme right for the simple reason that they fought the communists. In 1945, the Second World War ended and the Third World War started.
The autumn of 1944. Benito Mussolini would be dead in 6 months. Adolf Hitler in less than a year. As the Allied armies advanced on the capitals of Axis-occupied Europe, the other war, the secret war of agents and partisan groups that had always been part of the bigger war, was to reach its own climax.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao.
As the Germans withdrew, they left secret agents in the countries they had occupied. The secret services call such groups stay-behinds. For the retreating Germans, they were the staunchest believers. They were selected from the SS and the fascist Black Legions. They were to become the foot soldiers of the next war about to begin, the Cold War.
Le Palais des Sports de Bruxelles.
In Brussels, a massive meeting has been staged on the theme Peoples of Europe Against Bolshevism. We saw over there on the Russian plains the Italians and Croats, the Hungarians, Norwegians, the Danes, our Flemish brothers. We all met over there, these great forces which rose up. Why? Because they, too, had this vision of the truth. Let us do battle together.
Ahead of the advancing Allies, always with the first troops, was the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. And that part of the OSS charged with locating enemy stay-behinds had been given the designation X2.
Peter Tompkins, OSS Office, Rome, 1943-45.
I came in and sent by General Donovan and got in touch with the heads of the Committee of National, the military junta of the Committee of National, which is the joint partisan groups. Andy Birding was the first X2 guy who came into Rome. And he'd been an old AP correspondent, and I thought I could trust him, that he was a good guy. And so we turned over to him everything we had on the German stay-behinds. Then Jim Angleton appeared in August. He began recruiting fascists. because he figured that the best way to control the communists was to hire fascists. One of the most tough ones was Prince Valerio Borghese, who ran what was known as the 10th Flotilla. These are the guys that would execute partisans and hang them from lampposts all over Italy.
Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 oh, mamma mia. Oh, che tormento, io ti invoco ogni domani.
Angleton made a deal with Borghese and then rushed up to save this commander from the partisans who would have lynched him any time, because he had lynched thousands of partisans.
Vincenzo Vinci Guerra.
Prince Valerio Borghese takes us right to the heart of the American Secret Services. He was saved and protected by Angleton in 1945 when he gave himself up in Milan at the end of the Second World War in Italy. The Decemamas, the group that Valerio Borghese commanded, promised the Allies to take up arms in the event of a Soviet invasion.
Licio Gelli, later to head the secret P2 Masonic Lodge, had been a liaison officer attached to the SS. He had his own encounter with X2 agents.
Licio Gelli, venerable master of the P2 Masonic Lodge.
We were taken prisoners by a group of Canadians who handed us over to the ISS. I was treated well by them for about a week. In an apartment in Pistonia, they brought me a sheaf of paper, and the officer told me to write down my life story from my first communion to the present. A week later, they asked if I wanted to be parachuted into the north. It was a U.S. colonel who asked, but I said no, my work was over.
To show what a cynical game it is, this young policeman, Federico Umberto D'Amato, the night that the Allies came in to Rome, rounded up all the German stay-behinds, whose addresses he had, put them in jail, turned them over to the Americans, and they were disposed of.
The German stay-behinds were turned over to Italian authorities and sentenced by Italian military courts.
Federico Umberto D'Amato, head of the political police, Ministry of the Interior, 1972-74.
I was working at the hotel where General Meltzer was based. He was the head of German armed forces in Roma. The central command of the Abwehr Luftwaffe was also there. One day I managed to get into one of the rooms with some risk. I got hold of these lists of names. When the Germans left, contrary to my expectations, these people remained. Because there was an operation to leave people in place once they were retreating, so they wouldn't have to cross the lines. Something like, you know this better than I do. Operation Gladio. When the Americans came for these men, they were already in custody.
From that day of his joining Jim Angleton, or the X2 part of OSS, he ran the secret police for the next 40 years.
It was from that moment that I started working with him, always in agreements with my government and the authorities. Many police officers were forced to follow Mussolini north. They were in a sorry state at that time. Since my father was a police official and knew everyone, the X2 branch decided to parachute me, a complete novice, into the region of Saulo, where I luckily managed to arrive safely and where I met the main officials of the Republic of Saulo. they naturally agreed to cooperate. After the war, they became important leaders of the Italian state, the police forces, and the Ministry of Interior.
Now, the next character, who doesn't show his face, is introduced as Colonel Oswald Le Winter from the CIA ITAC Liaison Officer Europe, where ITAC is the Intelligence Tactical Assessment Center of the DIA. Liaison was assigned to a CIA officer. I'm going to give you a little bit of background to him. His official narrative, Wikipedia, as of August this year, presents him as a convincing storyteller, best known for his stories about the October Surprise controversy. Wikipedia still not accepting that the October Surprise conspiracy actually happened. That's another story, but Wikipedia is highlighting the claim that he's a chameleon who can show up and pretend to be anyone, anywhere. That, to me, falls a bit short of the facts, because things like his arrest in 1971 with an NYPD badge and diplomatic papers, including claims that he was a Knight of Malta, British authorities jailed him but decided not to pursue charges. In 1984, he was arrested for a $100 million scheme to smuggle methamphetamine into the US, including manufacturing it, sentenced to 6 years, but released after two. So this and a few other things as well, the October Surprise conspiracy, Lockerbie, he seems to be involved in quite a lot of information. Now, perhaps he is just an amazingly high-flying con man, in which case it seems odd that the authorities have pursued a light touch with him. I don't know what the going rate for methamphetamine production and smuggling is, but I would have thought 2 years for $100 million worth is pretty light. His statements have contradicted one another, and he has on occasion said, yes, I was lying before, now it's the truth. So we have to bear that in mind. That seems to me to be possibly he's a pathological liar. A lot more likely, though, given the various intrigues in which he does appear to me to have been involved, he's made a comment and people have lent on him to retract that comment. So he's been persuaded, who knows how, to change his testimony for the purposes of pleasing higher-ups in the power structure. He's also involved in a claim that Diana, Princess of Wales, and Dodi Fayed were unlawfully killed, and he claimed to have evidence of that. And Trowbridge H. Ford has claimed that Le Winter was Duane Claridge's deputy for European operations. Now, whether or not it's true, as one commentator noted, Oswald Le Winter is an article unto himself, one of hundreds feeding mystery meat into the sausage grinder of history, I thought it was worth having a little bit of a biographical detour before we continued with his testimony, since Frankovich makes extensive use of it in this video.
Gladio was a joint brainchild, but its most intense architect was Angleton. And Angleton, as most people know, was a sort of a professional paranoiac. One of his favorite sayings used to be that even paranoiacs have enemies. And Angleton was a fellow who felt that you couldn't trust anybody, particularly not any foreign country.
Federico Umberto D'Amato.
As time passes, as more is discovered about the Second World War and the period after that, namely the Cold War, you will learn what an extraordinary man Angleton was, a truly extraordinary man. Even to the point of being slightly crazy. For as Erasmus of Rotterdam said, a little madness is needed in everything. And when you were recruited by the OSS, which was the service that the CIA grew out of, there was a sign saying, to join the OSS, you don't have to be crazy, but it helps. I really think Angleton wrote that.
William Colby, Knight of Malta, attendee of Le Cercle, and Director of Central Intelligence from 1973 to 1976.
We sort of anticipated another world war, and a world war that would be characterized by an occupation of Western Europe by Soviet forces. And therefore, we were preparing to set up the base for a resistance movement which could exist during the war.
Now, the next speaker, Ray Klein, is subtitled as Deputy Director of the CIA, 1962 to 1966. In fact, he was Director of the Directorate of Intelligence in the CIA, possibly a small difference. Now, worth noting that he spoke at the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism that we looked at in episode 714.
The Soviet Union was viewed as our primary antagonist, our enemy, and I think that was true. The Stalinist period was a really vicious period in the Soviet Union, and we thought in the late 40s and early 50s that Stalin might invade Western Europe.
John Singlaup, U.S. Army Major General, 1972 to 78, and involved in Iran-Contra.
It was the plan that I knew about, that the people who had a logical reason for being in a given area where we felt it was essential to have stay-behinds, and whose activities could continue even after an attack by the Warsaw Pact, he would be given additional training. He would know the location of some of the arms and communications caches, and that he would be able, as a result of his training, to recruit additional personnel to augment his network, and that it would include not only just communications, but it would include the ability to use explosives.
The stay-behind effort, in my view, was simply to be sure that if the worst came to worst, if a Communist Party came into power, that there would be some agents there who would tip us off and tell us what was happening and be around to provide the information even after the coup might occur.
Thomas Polgar, CIA, Germany, 1951.
With the emergence of NATO in Western Europe, in specific response to the communist takeover in Czechoslovakia in 1948 and the Berlin blockade, directives were issued to establish Europe-wide stay-behind organizations along the lines which existed in the final years of World War II in Western Europe.
Oswald LeWinter.
There was an amendment to the NATO protocol, and that amendment was absolutely necessary. You didn't get in the door unless you sign. And what was in that amendment was the agreement of the government not to prosecute right-wing activists, right-wing activities, anti-communist activists in their own countries.
Ray Klein's.
It's not unlikely that some right-wing groups were recruited and made to be stay-behinds because they would indeed have tipped us off if a war were going to begin. So using right-wingers, if you use them not politically but for intelligence purposes, is okay.
Erhard Dabringhaus, U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, Germany, 1948-49.
In 1948, I was a special agent with CIC, that's our counterintelligence corps in occupied Germany. I was stationed in Augsburg, and as such, since I spoke fluent German, I was assigned to handle a network of German informants. Among them was Klaus Barbie. And Klaus Barbie was later on, I discovered that he was wanted for murder by the French, and that I reported this to my superiors, and they told me to keep nice and quiet. He's still valuable. When he's no longer valuable, we'll turn him over to the French. I thought that I was going to get a promotion when I told them about Barbie, and they told me to keep quiet. Colonel Gunther Bernau was an agent, an informant working for the military intelligence in Stuttgart. We had provided him a home, a safe house in Ludwigsburg, and there I met him three times a week, and he brought us information about communists and whatever we wanted to hear, he told us. He was certainly a very strong Nazi. I sat in his office one day and opened his album of pictures from the war, and in the middle of the album it showed a nice picture of Adolf Hitler. Several other high-ranking SS officers who came to visit him in his safe house that we had provided, and he told me that if for any reason he needs help, by one telephone call he could contact 200 former SS leaders from Hamburg to Munich. I remember him taking me to one particular spot, which we uncovered and dug it out, and there were rifles, small arms, grenades, all nicely wrapped in cosmoline, and he said, we have thousands of these all over the country. And that sort of made me a little suspicious, and I reported this, and they said, well, we know this. They're all working for us in case the communists come across the Iron Curtain. A former general, SS general, Paul Hauser, was a frequent visitor at Bernau's house, and they worked together hand in glove about certain programs, which we didn't know anything about, and I wasn't even asked to find out more about it. Somebody above me must have been running this network already at that time.
Oswald LeWinter.
The man in Adenauer's office, who also had, I guess, his fullest confidence, who oversaw Gladiot in its earliest stages, was a fellow named Dr. Glopke, who was an ex-Nazi, who Adenauer had brought into the government the way he'd brought a lot of ex-Nazis into the government, because I guess his position was that these were the only people who really had any administrative experience, and so they were, I guess, denazified, if you want to call it that. They were cleaned up a little bit like today, Nazi, tomorrow, Democrat, like changing undershirts.
What we were doing is either with the government secretly or independently on our own looking for people who might perform this function in some country where you didn't have that connection with the government or whatever, or maybe you did as a supplement. But maybe one or two extra people that would have this training who would stay there during a Soviet occupation and be the base that you could then talk about recruiting other people to join.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it this week due to time. Many thanks to all the volunteers who lent their voices to Alan Frankovich's film. It's not too late. I still need one or two more voices. If you'd like to, you can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, and offer to help. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco has lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Obama's geopolitical strategy for containing China, an interview with Professor Alfred McCoy. From time to time, TUC Radio presents programs produced by other people. The interview of Professor Alfred McCoy by my neighbor and fellow broadcaster Jeff Blankford at KZYX was such an extraordinary, revealing piece of U.S. imperial history that it drew an instant surprised response. The historian Alfred McCoy is an expert on U.S. foreign policy, the Philippines, Southeast Asia, global drug trafficking, and CIA covert operations. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his September 2015 piece in Tom Dispatch, entitled Grandmaster of the Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China, stands in total contrast to the current views of media pundits as well as the Republican Party. They see Obama as weak, clueless, and indecisive in matters of foreign policy. McCoy provocatively places Obama among the limited number of presidents and public figures whose geopolitical skills, if Obama is allowed to succeed, will have transformed America's global role. In this interview, McCoy takes listeners from Halford Mackinder, father of geopolitics, to Brzezinski, to Obama's efforts to interrupt China's global ambitions and maintain U.S. global hegemony. An important instrument for containing China are the two trade treaties, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TTIP. Here's the interview with Professor Alfred McCoy. Jeff Blankford asked him to lay out the leading idea in his article on Obama as the grand master of the great game.
A U.S. president negotiates treaties, interacts with leaders, and manages the crisis du jour, whether it's the Middle East or Asia or wherever it might be. And what I'm talking about is something deeper and longer and ultimately, I think, more significant and more substantial, geopolitics. Now, there's a relationship between foreign policy and geopolitics, but they're not the same. We've had a string of presidents throughout the 20th century and into the 21st who have been reasonably competent in the realm of foreign policy. Almost any American leader, given the enormous strength economically and militarily of this country, who is generally competent, can manage U.S. foreign policy pretty well. And that's all the way from Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, they're all pretty good at it, okay? And that's Republicans and Democrats alike. Foreign policy has traditionally been nonpartisan. But geopolitics requires something different, an uncommon ability to look beneath the chaos of the present and to bring two subtle issues into conjuncture, time and space. In other words, to make sure that your immediate foreign policy decisions are somehow impacting upon the complex undercurrents of changing global geopolitics in order to position the United States and to even change the world order in a fundamental and lasting kind of way. And the second ability you have to have, and this is very uncommon, is to have a kind of deep understanding, almost to the level of being an intuitive understanding of the culture, the people, and the places on the planet, who some are the nations, if you will, the counters, the pieces on the global chessboard. So that when you make your move in the present to shape the future, you know pretty much what you're doing. And applying this standard means that when you look back, in my view, and others might disagree, over the century plus since the United States emerged on the world stage, during the Spanish-American War of 1898, there have only been three American leaders who have been adept at this more subtle long-term art of geopolitics. The first was Elihu Root, who was a Secretary of War, which is like Secretary of Defense today. He was Secretary of State. He was a U.S. Senator from the state of New York. He was a plenipotentiary. And he was the architect of U.S. global power. He transformed us from an insular nation into a major power. The second was Zbigniew Brzezinski. As a national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, he had an intuitive understanding of the master of geopolitics, the man who defined the field, a man named Sir Halford Mackinder. We can talk about him later. Brzezinski was a kind of intellectual acolyte of Mackinder, and he proved to be brilliant in manipulating the geopolitics that in a way that drew the Soviet Union into Afghanistan and gave them what he called their Vietnam, and then half a world away broke up the Soviet Empire and freed Eastern Europe from the grip of Soviet dominion. And the most recent one, I would argue, is President Barack Obama, who is both is in a certain sense falling in the footsteps of both Elihu Root, protecting the U.S. position and the international community that Root helped to create, and retaining the United States status as a possibly retaining the United States status as the world's sole superpower, something that Zbigniew Brzezinski was largely responsible for by his deft defeat of the Soviet Union. What Obama's strategy is, it's a counter to China's strategy. To understand what China is really up to, we have to go back to a lecture on a dark London night in January 1904, when the director of the London School of Economics and a well-known British geographer gave a lecture called The Geographical Pivot of History. And this lecture is important in terms of what it said specifically about the Eurasian landmass, but it's more important because this lecture is the lecture that invented the study of geopolitics. Okay, I mean, that, if you will, looked at the relationship between geography and political power and therefore global power. And what Sir Halford Mackinder said is he redrew the map. He took the globe and he twisted it so that he shifted it slightly north and he moved it so its center was right at the heart of the vast Eurasian landmass. And he said, when you look at the globe this way, what you see is that Europe, Africa, and Asia are not three continents. They're actually a single landmass that he called the World Island. And he said that the pivot, the geographical pivot of history, was in the heartland of the World Island, which is basically the vast steppes of the Soviet Union, 4,000 miles sort of stretching across the then Russia all the way up to the East Siberian Sea. And he said that he who controls the heartland controls the World Island, and he who controls the World Island controls the world. And Sir Halford Mackinder was writing actually at a moment when Tsarist Russia was just extending the Trans-Siberian Railway across the vast Eurasian landmass. So for the first time, the two continents were actually being joined by a logistical link, this great Trans-Siberian Railway. And what China began doing 10 years ago was realizing Sir Halford Mackinder's vision. They have spent and are spending the better part of $1 trillion to build an amazing array of gas pipelines, oil pipelines, high-speed rails across China, and rail links, potentially a high-speed rail link between Beijing and Moscow, that's actually knitting together the world island right from the what Mackinder called the geographical pivot of history, the heartland of the world island, linking Central Asia to China. And then China's second part of its strategy, very closely linked to the first part, okay, was to defeat, to cut the encirclement of the world island. Now, at the end of World War II, and I'm drawing here upon the distinguished British imperial historian, a man named John Darwin. He said the United States became the greatest empire in history because for the first time, the United States controlled both axial points of the Eurasian landmass, that through NATO and Western Europe, and our relationship with Japan and East Asia, we had control over the axial points of the vast Eurasian landmass. And we, over the 50-plus years that followed World War II, we erected, if you will, a massive array of military power around the periphery of this giant world island. First of all, a string of treaties that stretch from NATO to CENTO to CETO, the Australia, New Zealand, U.S. Security Pact, the Japan, U.S. Security Treaty. And then we had our great fleets, the 6th Fleet, the 7th Fleet, and ultimately the 5th Fleet. And then most recently we've built a string of something like 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily to Guam that allow our drones to strike all around this vast world island. And what China appears to be doing is strategically coming up with a way to cut through, to slice this massive U.S. armada that encircles the Eurasian landmass at two points. First, those islands in the South China Sea, and they are geopolitically very important. Also, the Chinese in their Hainan naval base are, in fact, homeporting nuclear submarines, which will be operating in the South China Sea. But of equal significance, the Chinese have built another point of attack. They have built, at the cost of something like $200 billion, a new port at Gwadar in Balochistan, Pakistan, just a day's sail from the Straits of Hormuz, the mouth of the strategically important Persian Gulf. And they are now, President Xi Jinping, in a recent state visit to Pakistan, announced the construction of a corridor of roads, rails, oil pipelines, gas pipelines that are going to run from Gwadar all the way to western China. And this gives China, if you will, a future home port right on the Arabian Sea, a day's steam, a day's sail from the Persian Gulf. And this way China can slice through the world island. That's China's strategy, the world island strategy, if you will, a continental strategy. So what's Obama, about the time Obama took office, it was clear that China was making a bid. And nobody paid attention to it except the Obama administration. And secretly and subtly, they began preparing a counter-strategy. And in the past few months, we've just begun to see it. And it's a two-part strategy. First of all, at the most visible level, the United States is negotiating two trade pacts, which are very controversial and have high costs. I'm not a keen fan of them myself, but nonetheless, geopolitically, very important. A Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a dozen nations, including the United States, the most tight economic integration of any trade pact in history. And then the other one is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP. And these two treaties, if successful, will give the United States preferential access to about 60% of global domestic products, 60% of the world's economy. But what it'll do geopolitically is it's going to split the world island, this Eurasian landmass, okay, and pull the Asian half towards the United States across the Pacific, right? And it's going to take the European Union, which has, by the way, the world's single largest economy, and split the western half of the Eurasian landmass, the European half, and pull that across the Atlantic, and thereby split apart China's bid to unify Africa, Asia, and Latin America economically and logistically into that unified world island. Geopolitically, it's a stunning move whose import, I think, you can only see when you realize that we're contesting China, we're containing China, and it's a bid that, more than any other single strategy, has a chance to extend U.S. global power, U.S. hegemony, U.S. dominion deeper into the 21st century.
That's Professor Alfred McCoy, historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's being interviewed by Jeff Blankford, host of the foreign policy program Takes on the World on KZYX. The full interview was 35 minutes long and needed to be edited to fit into the TUC radio time slot. Even though the huge trade agreements, the TPP and the TTIP, are important instruments in excluding China and preserving U.S. hegemony, I edited some of the details. The loss of sovereignty, the limits placed on the participating countries' laws on food safety, environmental and worker protection, have been addressed. The secret tribunals that can dismantle constitutional guarantees of member countries for the benefit of corporate power and profit have been criticized. But the wide sweep and historic depth of Professor McCoy's article, Grand Master of the Great Game, Obama's Geopolitical Strategy for Containing China, can only be found online at Tom Dispatch or on public radio today. Back to Professor Alfred McCoy.
There's another dimension, by the way, of Obama's geopolitical strategy, I think, that also bears commenting on, is it's his determination, if you will, to repair the damage of the past. In other words, these treaties are looking forward to the future. But Obama's had to look at repairing past damage from past administrations that acted unilaterally, starting with the beginning of the Cold War, almost up to the present. Yeah, at the start of the Cold War, as the European empires that controlled about half of humanity were retreating, and 100 new sovereign states were emerging very quickly, starting in the Truman administration and particularly under the Eisenhower administration, there was a shift in global power. European empires were collapsing. The United States was ascendant as the world's dominant economy. We controlled about half of global production at that point. We were the overwhelmingly strong military power. And so the United States was emerging during the 1940s and 50s as the new global hegemon, the new power, many would say the most powerful empire that ever existed. And under President Truman, President Truman created the new instruments of U.S. global power, the National Security Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. Air Force. And then under Dwight Eisenhower, he was the one that actually began to operate these new instruments of global power. And I think drawing upon his experience as Allied commander in Europe during World War II, Eisenhower kind of turned the National Security Council into his sort of staff. It became very large and met regularly, hundreds of times under Eisenhower, to review hotspots and make foreign policy decisions. So the National Security Council was his staff, and the CIA was his secret army. And Eisenhower, during his term, 8 years in office, ordered 170 covert operations in 48 nations. Now, among all these covert operations, there were three that were particularly disastrous and turned three sovereign states into bitter enemies of the United States. The first was under President Truman. In 1950-51 and into 52, Truman ordered the CIA to transform the remnants of the nationalist Chinese forces that had fled into northeastern Burma when Mao Zedong took power in Beijing in 1949, established the People's Republic of China, Communist China. Well, these nationalist Chinese remnants were then armed and trained by the CIA, and they conducted three abortive invasions of the People's Republic of China in 1951-52, and they were brushed back by mere provincial militia into northeastern Burma. And then again with CIA logistic support and CIA arms and money, they basically occupied northeastern Burma. The U.S. ambassador to Burma resigned in protest. Burma took its complaint to the U.N., and eventually the Nationalist Chinese forces pulled out where they ran the drug trade in northern Thailand for the next 40 years. This was a time when Burma was just established. They were only established in 1947. They were inclined to be insular. They were quite sensitive as a nation, and suddenly they found their borderlands being used as being sort of taken over by the world's hegemonic power. And this alienated Burma from the United States and indeed from the broader international community. So as President of the United States, sensing that America's encirclement of the Eurasian landmass that I described with the Navy and the treaties and most recently the network of drone bases, that China developed a special relationship with the Union of Burma and got preferential access to its very considerable resources, and more importantly, got a base in the Bay of Bengal for oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines, and provisioned the 100 million people in southwestern China. But this was, if you will, a breach in America's containment. So He sent Secretary Hillary Clinton to be the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Burma in decades. He appointed the first U.S. ambassador to Burma in, I think, 22 years, and he made the first state visit ever by an American president to the Union of Burma to heal that relationship and to draw Burma away from China into the international community. The second one he did was, of course, Iran. In 1953, in the early 1950s, there was a popularly elected prime minister, Mossadegh, who challenged the Anglo-Iranian oil company, the British imperial control over Iran's oil industry, that's now BP, and he began nationalizing that company. The British intelligence and the CIA collaborated in overthrowing the Mossadegh government. The attempt nearly failed, but at the last minute it succeeded. They installed the Shah of Iran in power. And then over the next two decades, the CIA built the SAVAK, the ruthless secret police for the Shah, as a surveillance, torture, and interrogation unit. And while all of this, you know, covert operations derring do was toasted in Washington as sort of deliciously brilliant, meanwhile, Iran was seething. And, of course, the events of 1979 followed the seizure and occupation of the U.S. Embassy, the overthrow of the Shah, and a persistent breach in U.S. relations with Iran that weakened Washington's position very seriously in the Middle East. Well, of course, we all know that Obama, beginning in 2013, began conducting those negotiations to check Iran's move to possibly developing a nuclear weapons capacity. And again, we don't know, but it's clear that this is going to bring at least Iran back into the international community and may, in the fullness of time, begin healing the breach between the United States and Iran. The last one, of course, was Cuba. Under President Eisenhower, as he was leaving office in 1960, he authorized a covert operation to send 1,000-plus ragtag Cuban-American exiles to land somewhere in Cuba. When President Kennedy was inaugurated and he inherited this operation that was all planned and ready to go, President Kennedy sensed that it wasn't quite right. He was young. He was inexperienced. This was in the first weeks of his administration. And so he basically ordered the CIA to cut back, you know, to land in a more remote area, to cut back the scale of its air power support for the landing. And what they wound up doing was dumping 1,000-plus Cuban exiles on a beach at the Bay of Pigs, and they were supposed to, you know, to go from that beachhead to the Escambray Mountains. Well, if you look at the map, you'll see that they were supposed to go through 50 miles of dense mangrove swamp and cross a bay without any inflatable rafts. In other words, they were dumped on a beach 50 impossible miles from the mountains that they couldn't get to. And the CIA in Washington sat back as the Cuban Air Force blasted the exiles into surrender. Well, as we all know, Pope Francis is the mediator. Washington has now recognized Cuba again. We've reopened our embassy, the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C. It just reopened in the last few days. And we're now looking towards the resumption of fuller diplomatic relations and the possible removal of sanctions against Cuba. And so these three breaches in U.S. foreign policy of these three embittered nations is something that Obama has also healed during his term in office.
What happens when Obama leaves office? Do you think this program will continue, or are the corporate players who have been supporting Obama going to come and talk to the next president, whoever that is, and explain what has been going on?
I think that the momentum for certainly the Trans-Pacific Partnership is almost unstoppable at this point. In this era of hyper-partisanship, where Democrats and Republicans can agree on almost nothing, all right? What's extraordinary is you have a Democratic administration, arguably the most vilified Democratic administration by the Republicans of any in recent memory, all right, winning the fast-track authority for the approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Republican votes. This is one of the very few genuinely bipartisan actions by the Obama administration. And this means that there are business interests behind the Republican Party There is that element of the business portion of the Republican Party, separate from the Tea Party and the more populist strains, that recognize the importance of this treaty in securing the position of the United States and U.S. corporations globally. And I think those interests are going to, that are manifested in that bipartisan vote for the Fast Track Authority will mean that this is going to continue into the next administration. I mean, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was the ally of Obama in developing this strategy. So if she winds up to be the Democratic nominee and the next president of the United States, well, it's very clear that will move forward. There will be an absolute continuity in U.S. foreign policy. And she's also, as a candidate, a former senator from New York, very close to the same kind of corporate and financial interests that are very sympathetic and very supportive of both of these treaties, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership. And I think if a Republican is elected, and it's difficult to say, if you just go for the two front runners, Trump and Bush, very likely the same continuity will come into play. This involves U.S. global power at the highest level, and it's at this level, just as we saw in the Cold War, in which there is still bipartisanship. Bipartisan U.S. foreign policy comes into play when the most powerful U.S. interests are at stake.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Today we live in a society where the discourse of cultural difference is what reproduces racialized divisions and racialized processes of racialization.
That's the voice of UBC Professor Sunara Tubani. On this week's show, we speak to Sunara about her book, Exalted Subjects, so stay tuned.
We're very privileged to have as our guest Dr. Sunara Tubani. She is the author of Exalted Subjects. To put a little light onto how have we come to create this society that seems almost oblivious to what really matters. Sunara Tubani is an assistant professor at the Center for Women's and Gender Studies at the University of British Columbia. Her research focuses on race and gender relations and migration, citizens and nation building. She was the first woman of color to serve as president of the National Action Committee of the Status of Women, the NAC, between 1993 and 1996. During that time, along with Canadian Labor Congress, she organized the National Women's March Against Poverty. She made national news in October of 2001 as one of the first critics of the U.S. foreign policy on the war on terror when she stated, "From Chile to El Salvador to Nicaragua to Iraq, the path of U.S. foreign policy is soaked in blood." Very happy to have you on our show. Welcome to our show, Dr. Tubani.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Now, your words sparked a great deal of lashback against you. And I want to begin talking about how does this war on terrorism exacerbated the racism that seems to fuel a system of capitalism?
Well, the war on terror is actually ideologically framed around a supposed defense of Western civilization and Western culture. And the West, of course, is a deeply racialized entity. Historically, it was in Europe's relations with its others, the world that it subsequently colonized, that the idea and the identity of the West came into being. So the war on terror is deeply racialized through this discourse of kind of reconstituting, re-energizing a Western civilization. So that's one way in which it has kind of drawn upon historical forms of racism and is re-articulating them for the 21st century. The other part of the racism around the war on terror is, of course, the intense Islamophobia that it has unleashed around the world. And so this fear and hatred of Muslims around which nations are developing their kind of conceptions of national identity, national security, who it is that is the enemy of this. And so the figure of the Muslim has, again, you know, emerged as this deeply racial figure.
In your book, Exalted Subjects, you spelled out how this exalted subject is constructed in contrast to the other. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in Exalted Subjects, I really wanted to see how a settler society like Canada, like the U.S., and, you know, other countries like New Zealand, Australia, how is it that a settler society transforms itself into a nation? How does it organize access to this nation? What are the kinds of exclusions and inclusions that allow this society to function and to remake itself? And so it was in asking questions like that that I began to see that part of the process through which a nation is constituted is by defining its nationals, defining what their identity is. And in Canada, of course, Canadians like to think of themselves as compassionate, humanitarian, law-abiding, unlike others, unlike immigrants who are seen as, you know, bending immigration laws and regulations, who attempt to enter the country legally or otherwise to take benefit of its generous social programs. And so whereas Canadians are constituted as compassionate, caring, sharing, immigrants are seen as somehow lacking that very human capacity. Aboriginal people, on the other hand, are also not seen as compassionate, humanitarian. Instead, they are constituted as always wanting more and more from Canadians. So I began to look at how this identity is constructed, which, you know, gives a kind of human dimension to who the Canadian is. And it was in identifying those qualities that I, you know, came up with the idea of exaltation as a process through which the state binds its nationals to itself by defining their humanity in particularly, you know, positive and exalted terms. To be compassionate, to be humanitarian is something that is a very kind of exalted aspect of being a human being. But it's through nationalizing these human capacities and qualities and enshrining them in state policy that the state actually binds its nationals to itself. And so I, you know, came to identify this as a process of exaltation, and the subjects who are included in this process as exalted themselves.
And that's an important connection to make, because when we see ourselves as different from others and somehow superior by our moral qualities or whatever identity characteristics that we want to exalt, it leads a way for a lot of room for subjective observations. And in the case of the war, particularly the war in Afghanistan, many people did not oppose the war. And as this exaltation of how some wars are just and some are justifiable, talk a little bit about how do we negotiate then those contrasting views that seem to be, we're allowing decisions to be made that are against our very own interests. The multiculturalism discourse almost paralyzes a movement of social justice, a movement against otherness that allows this kind of disparity.
First of all, we can see ourselves in whatever we want to. But how you see yourself has to be recognized and reflected back to you by the society in which you live. So, for example, Canadians can call themselves compassionate. They can see themselves as compassionate and caring. And the state responds by developing social policies that are kind of, you know, are based around this idea of compassion sharing. So the first thing is to see how deeply the state is implicated in how we see ourselves. It's not just individual choices, individual preferences, but the state and state policy play a key role in how we see ourselves is reflected back to us at the level of social life. In terms of the Afghan war, I think the quality which best exemplifies how Canadians have been recruited into supporting these wars or nationalized into supporting this war is by defining it as a benevolent project. You know, Canadians tell themselves that they have gone to Afghanistan to save little Afghan girls, to allow Afghan girls to go to school, to save Afghan women. And so the quality, the very human quality of benevolence is here being nationalized by the state. Canadians are benevolent. They want to help. And so it's a state policy that fixes itself in a notion of Canadian goodness, of helping, rather than Canadians seeing themselves as, you know, engaged in a war, which has resulted in the deaths of, you know, tens of thousands of Afghan women, children. So the quality of benevolence, we see it working very clearly in how the Afghan war is being fought. And we also see how ideologically it is so important, because Canadian support for the war is a popular public support for the war was actually rooted in this idea of benevolence and Canadians wanting to help and save and do good. So the state is deeply implicated in how we, quote unquote, come to see ourselves. So the one thing is to never lose sight of the role of state policy and state practices. In terms of the question around multiculturalism and the impact it has had of paralyzing social movements, again, I look at multiculturalism as official state policy in my book. I look at how multiculturalism has at one level really stabilized the national subject, the Canadian national subject, as essentially white, because it's in relation to the nation, which is defined as bicultural, bilingual, English and French, that other cultures are to be respected, tolerated, even liked sometimes. And so multiculturalism preserves the core of the nation as essentially white, as English and French. And it's in relation to this true national subject that others are to be tolerated, respected. And so multiculturalism in a way furthers a racial politics, only it does it in the discourse of cultural difference. And multiculturalism has had a very, agree with you, a very negative impact on social movements, because it has allowed people of color to be constituted as other, as culturally different. And so the struggles that people of color face in Canada are issues around political power, around economic participation, around access to resources. And these all get reframed by the language of multiculturalism into issues of cultural difference. And, you know, many on the left, many social movements themselves adopt these kinds of definitions of people of color. And they do see issues through the lens of cultural difference, which really works against a solidarity that's based on a similarity of human experience. And so cultural difference has become the lens through which social movements, including the women's movements, continues to see people of color. In many ways, even as the social movements contest the state, contest the powers that organize Canadian society, when it comes to people of color, it actually accepts and reproduces the same definitions of these people and what their issues are as the state does. And so multiculturalism has really, you know, driven divisions amongst groups who I would argue have a solidarity based on their experience if it wasn't viewed through the lens of cultural difference.
Could you talk a little bit about how has this benevolent notion of Canada as a notion that's not founded on genocide or colonization allowed not only the invisibility of Indigenous people as a people, but has also exacerbated the abuses and erosion of their human rights?
Well, I think it's very important, you know, the point you raise is very important. I think that, you know, the starting point for my work, my analysis, is that Canadian nationhood remains dependent upon the suppression of Aboriginal peoples. And so the colonization of Aboriginal peoples is actually ongoing. It happens every day at the sites of our daily life. And so I think an important thing is to realize that this colonization and genocide of Aboriginal people is not actually something that happened in the past. It continues at an everyday level. Aboriginal people are struggling for sovereignty even today. You know, how is it that Canadian subjects, national subjects, have come to understand their relationship to Aboriginal people? With the founding of the nation, Aboriginal people were constituted as lawless, as quote-unquote savages, that they did not have civilized systems of governance. This, of course, was a complete lie. But the idea that Canadians are law-abiding is really based on their distinction from Aboriginal people who were defined as living in lawless societies. You know, one of the ways in which these kind of colonial identities and colonial relations get reproduced today are by Canadians being proud of themselves to, you know, stand by the law. And the law says that Aboriginal people are only entitled to this much. Well, the law was central in the colonization of Aboriginal people. Europeans brought over to the Americas their own systems of law. They suppressed and destroyed Aboriginal forms of legality, structures of governance, and imposed their own. And so law has been complicit. So I think that when Canadians think of themselves as living in a society that respects law and order, this is a deeply colonial construct that is implicated in the dispossession of Aboriginal people. Today, of course, Canadians prefer not to remember this history. And, you know, they kind of choose to look at their relationships with Aboriginal people as they exist today. And often I hear arguments, many times from students as well, that Aboriginal people get too much federal funding, they get too much money, they are not self-reliant, they are not sharing the same values as of a work ethic, entrepreneurial, enterprising as Canadians do. And they also tend to formulate the status of Aboriginal people within a culturalist lens. Oh, their cultures are more spiritual, will be the positive argument. Their cultures are more deviant, will be the negative argument. But the frame of cultural difference, again, helps Canadians to not face the role of law, the role of economic policy, the role of property rights in terms of the dispossession of Aboriginal people, which remains ongoing even today.
Could you talk a little bit about the institutions that have enabled the erosion of Indigenous rights? And in your book, you talk specifically about the role of genocide and the residential schools. For many people, they're now closed. But what has replaced the system of residential schools, and what is the compounded impact on these communities and on Canadians as a whole?
Whether the issue is one of race or more is kind of the big question, yes? I think it's really important to be clear about what we mean by race. Do we mean just physical, biological kind of differences in the way that race was defined by scientific theories of racism in the 19th century? Do we mean race as cultural difference as race gets to be constituted today in the 21st century? You know, when I think about race, for me, race is, I cannot think about the economy without thinking about race. Because, you know, when we talk about institutions, the residential school system, it was Indian children, quote-unquote, defined as Indian, who were put into residential school systems. Well, that was a racial project. If we look at law, for example, in the way that I talked about it, the imposition of European forms of law and legal institutions, parliamentary model, onto Aboriginal peoples who lived in Canada. Now, that becomes race as well. So the legal system can't be understood fully in all of its colonial dimensions without seeing how race was central to it. Property rights. Who could buy property where? Who could own land and who could not? Was defined by race. Aboriginal people could not. They were dispossessed of their territories. They were seen as not being involved in the institution of private property rights. And so when who had mobility, who could move to any part of the country, live where they wanted to, where they could find work, Aboriginal people were restricted from doing that on the basis of their race. So I think if we have an expanded definition of race, where we begin to understand not just its physical and biological definitions and effects, but also its kind of legal, economic, social institutions and effects as well. When we're talking about race, we're talking of something really quite fundamental to how the global economy is organized, to how the current social order is organized. So I think we have to be careful about how we're defining these terms. I think that we can talk about race or more, but we have to be clear in understanding what we actually mean by race. For me, race is pretty central in terms of how the whole capitalist order is organized, how the global economy is organized, the division between the North and the South that we see today, which earlier was the division between the colonized world and the colonizing world. All of these, for me, are part of race and part of how race is organized. They're all racial projects, if you will. When we talk about human equality, now this also, you know, we can't take the term human for granted, because when we say human, what does the human mean? For the last 500 years, Europeans and Euro-Americans and Canadians have defined themselves as the real measure of the human. They have defined their particular experience as the human experience. In my book, I look at how the very human qualities of Canadians, how they define their own humanity, is so deeply shaped by economic processes, by the development of capitalism, by the development of the welfare state. So what do we mean when we say human? And one of the ways in which colonial relations have been reproduced is by white people defining themselves as the universal human being. So when we say we all just want to be human, what is it that we're talking about? Because being human has been a way in which these systems and processes of oppression and exploitation have been organized. So we need to unpack also the category human. What do we actually mean by that? And it has to be a kind of self-conscious, self-reflexive definition of the human, which takes into account the way in which this category of the human legitimizes certain forms of oppression. It works today in the war on terror, where Muslim Islamists, for example, are seen as hateful, violent people who hate human civilization, which is equated with Western civilization. They're defined as barbaric, as less than human. They can be killed today anywhere in the world without any kind of legal system coming into play. We see targeted assassinations take place in Palestine, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. And so Muslims today are defined as less than human. So when we say we want to be human, we surely don't mean the American imperial subject today, in whose name this war for Western civilization is being fought. So these are deeply loaded terms. They're deeply racialized terms. For a long time, the human meant the white European. People of color were not even defined as human. So we have to, you know, think about human and define in a very different way than this term has historically been defined, and the way that this term has also been colonized by whites through racial politics. In terms of your question around the residential school system, what has replaced it? You know, I look at residential school system in my book, and I argue, as many other people have argued, indigenous people, Aboriginal scholars argue, that the residential school system ended, but what replaced it was the child welfare system of the welfare state. And what we see is a disproportionate level of apprehension of Aboriginal children who, instead of being put into the residential school system, were apprehended by the state, taken into the child welfare system of the welfare state, and then put into foster homes, often with white families, given up for adoption, some of them even given up for adoption outside the country. And so very clearly, the child welfare system is what replaced the residential school system in terms of how Aboriginal children and families get to be treated and defined within Canadian state policy and within the society at large.
I wonder if you could talk about the way in which it has been essential to create this other in society, how it has served as the scapegoat, as you call it in your book, the scapegoat and immigrant. And if you could talk talk about what this tells us about our current policies in terms of immigration?
Okay, so immigration has been central to the founding of the Canadian nation and state, and continues to remain so. Immigrant, of course, is a deeply racialized term. As I discuss in my book, immigrants were defined as non-preferred races before the 1950s, and the non-preferred races were black people, Asians, South Asians, and non-white people basically were defined as non-preferred races. So immigrant is a deeply racialized term because, of course, white immigrants came from the UK, from France, from Eastern Europe, and all of them defined as preferred races in Canadian state policies were integrated into what then became the Canadian nation. So immigration has been central not only to the presence of immigrant communities in Canadian society, but to the very construction of Canadian society itself. White immigrants became integrated, as they do even today. We have, whites who come from America, from Australia, many came from South Africa. They are not treated or talked about as immigrants. They get, incorporated into the whiteness of the nation. People of color, on the other hand, continue to be reproduced as immigrants through this racialization of this category. Now, immigration continues to remain vital to the Canadian nation and state because immigrants provide labor that is very, very important to the development of the national economy. And immigrants, of course, also provide the population base. They provide taxes, fund the welfare state. The birth rate in Canada has actually been declining, and so it is below replacement level. So for the foreseeable future, immigration continues to remain absolutely vital to Canadian national interest. Now, I think that, in my book I argue that the Canadian state is actually faced with two issues around immigration. One is how to ensure that the labor is for economic growth, economic development, which means increased immigration from the third world. But on the other hand, how to continue to reproduce the whiteness of the nation, because Canada still continues to define itself as essentially bilingual and bicultural. So how then to continue defining it and reproducing it as a Western nation, which means essentially a white nation committed to European systems, social systems and values. So this is a big challenge. And one way in which this challenge gets dealt with is to reproduce immigrants as outsiders to the nation. They may be here, they live here, they work here, we contribute everything that we can to this society, but we continue to remain outsiders to this nation, which, preserves the core of the nation as white. In terms of the question that you're asking, in times of economic difficulties, it becomes very easy then to blame the immigrant, to scapegoat the immigrant. They become the cause of the problem, not the state, not its policies, not the economic system, but it's the immigrant who gets blamed. I mean, the common stereotypes, the common complaints, oh, immigrants come here and they take our jobs away. This is why some Canadians remain unemployed, they're poor. And so immigrants function as this kind of scapegoat and directing attention away from the policies of the state, from the inequalities that are deeply embedded in our economic and social and political institutions. Immigrants then become a handy kind of, a tool. We also see immigrants now being used to justify the new anti-terrorism measures, the new surveillance policies that have come into play. Immigrants, Muslims, come into the country. Many of them might be potential terrorists. And so immigrants get scapegoated in that kind of way today to help justify the kind of transformation of the welfare state into a national security state with immensely enhanced powers of repression, which then we see being used against other populations as well. We see what happens at demonstrations, the G20 was a very good example of that. These powers, enhanced repressive powers of the state, get used against Aboriginal people, but they get legitimized through scapegoating immigrants today as potential threats to national security. So we see immigrants being used and scapegoated and integrated into Canadian society in particular kinds of ways, but in ways that have historically maintained our status as outsiders to the nation, as less than real Canadians who are English and French and you know, since then white Canadians, and therefore entitled to greater surveillance, greater security measures, and lesser entitlements.
How do we create a system that's not racist, that's not exploitive?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is to refuse to adopt a definition of racism that focuses only at the individual level and only at the level of interpersonal interactions. We have to insist that its systemic, structural, and historical nature is also taken into consideration. And when I say historical, again, I mean historical in the sense that this history continues to be present in the contemporary. So we have to, you know, for example, instead of treating the genocide of Aboriginal people as something in the past, to continue to understand that history, but to see how it gets reproduced in the present. The first step would be to kind of reject this individualized definition of racism, which is promoted in the media, promoted by the state, promoted by, you know, many status quo intellectuals. And instead, we have to really look at its systemic, structural nature and also understand that it continues to change, that processes of racialization do not remain the same. Today, we live in a society where the discourse of cultural difference is what reproduces racialized divisions and racialized processes of racialization. So in a way, cultural difference stands in for the idea of racial difference. So when we use this culturalist language, we have to be continuously interrogating it, thinking about what it is accomplishing. So that becomes a very important point today, especially when we live in a society that is, quote-unquote, multiculturalist, that organizes communities in this society on the basis of culture, where previously it used to organize communities on the basis of race and racial difference. So, you know, continue to look at the social processes that underpin the constitution of particular kinds of communities. And for me, the question that is absolutely central is that of power relations. How does power function in how these communities are defined and they define themselves? Where is the power located? How does it function? So, you know, always the question of power. How does it operate? How is it organized? And how is it concealed? And the language of cultural difference actually conceals how state power works in Canadian society.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Sunera Tubani. Dr. Tubani is the author of Exalted Subject Studies in the Making of Race and Nation in Canada. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.